Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 23rd, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is the final live show of the year for the Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. On the program today, the January 6th committee issues its final report. Also on the program today, that report says Congress should ban Trump from running for president again. Meanwhile, New York Governor Hochul makes a Cuomo turn. She is slammed for nominating a conservative chief justice in New York. Meanwhile, the representative congressional elect, George Santos, his story gets weirder and weirder, and now maybe criminally so. Sam Bankman-Fried, speaking of criminally, released on $250 million bond.
In fiat, I think.
Fiat currency. Senate passes a $1.7 trillion spending bill. Still not really quite sure of everything that's in that. DeSantis appoints a judge who denied a 17-year-old girl an abortion because she had bad grades.
All right.
SEC Gensler says crypto must abide by existing regulations. And Arizona Governor Ducey, outgoing, I should say, Arizona Governor Ducey, has agreed to remove his dumb shipping container wall.
Rhino.
Cost $123 million to put it there. Who knows how much to take it away? All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday, perhaps the most casual of all casual Fridays. I wore a collared shirt.
Yeah. I did too, actually. I mean, I don't know if this counts.
Emma has flannel. Yeah. Thing, so. But it is the final Friday. Really, not even just the final Friday, the final day of 2022 that we will be live. Now, we have a whole set of best ofs that are pretty amazing best ofs, I have to say. Not the least of which, talk about the, you know, sort of the little more comedic, lighter things that follow them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the final Friday of the year, final day of the year that we're live. We will take phone calls instead of doing the normal thing where we, and then we'll have Matthew Film Guy up because there's a breaking story in Matthew Film Guy.
The Matthew Film Guy universe?
Yeah. Yep. And so this could be the biggest Matthew Film Guy story ever.
Wow.
And we will get to that a little bit later. We've got plenty to cover today. Starting with this, we spoke about the little feud brewing between Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert in the House around their competing allegiances or lack of allegiance to Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy running for Speaker of the House, essentially, and there's a bunch of Republicans who don't want him in there. This is, and let's be clear, like, this is not an ideological battle. This
no.
is a, you know, Coke and Pepsi. Which flavor do you want to be on? Whose team are you on? Who is...
How are you going to exploit the labor to make it?
Right, exactly. Which one of us is going to get the opportunity to do that? And Gates and Bobert, I don't want to say they're principled. They just must be sort of on the outs. I don't know where Gates was usually a much bigger Trump guy. Marjorie Taylor Greene is swinging Trump around as a way of saying they don't want Kevin McCarthy.
And Gates and Marjorie Taylor Greene were buddies. They did like World Tour of America or whatever. Remember, they had that whole speaking tour where they worked together. So interesting shift. Also, I think Boebert's a little worried since her reelection was so narrow and she almost lost it to a Democrat. Maybe distancing herself from Trump is the right way to go.
Yes. I mean, who knows exactly what's going on there? Maybe it's just personalities. But it is spilling out all over the place. Even Brian Kilmeade is getting a little bit annoyed. Shouldn't you guys have worked this out by now? Here he is on Fox and Friends. He is getting very, very pissy.
It looks like Kevin McCarthy is stuck. He does not have the votes. Matt Gaetz wrote a column the other day, says, I'm never voting for him. He stands for nothing. Have you been approached about being the next speaker if McCarthy can't get it done? And what do you say to those people that don't want to vote for him, who are in your party?
Yeah, no, look, I support Kevin, and I think there's still a lot of conversations that are going on, and Kevin's working to get there. He's going to get there. And that's just been an ongoing conversation this week. We've had a number of additional meetings with leadership and rank and file members going through rules changes. You know, what you hear the most is people are so frustrated with the way the House has been run, and we're going to be changing that. There are a lot of changes coming. And, you know, this is today is the big frustration because it really takes some of that leverage away from us when we get into the new majority. But, you know, we're going to continue moving forward. We've got work to do, and it's going to be a busy next year. I think you're going to be excited to see
who's changed their vote. Andy Buggs, Andy Biggs. You have Congressman Good. You have Matt Gaetz. Is anyone showing signs of budging, of moving off? Because as you know more better than anybody else, nothing can get done. You can't format chairmanship. You can't set up an agenda without a speaker.
Right. We've got to first elect the speaker and then get to work. And so Kevin's meeting with all of those members that you mentioned. We're meeting with a lot of them as a leadership team to go through rules changes. And then Kevin's meeting with them individually as well. So, you know, there's still time to go. And that work continues on.
Now, it's really difficult to know exactly who wants what, but you have a limited amount of the sort of like high profile committees. Let's be clear. There's no one who has any legislative priorities. There are no legislative priorities for the Republicans in the House. They obviously can't pass any laws because it's going to get shot down in the Senate. But even if they could, all you need to do is harken back to the first 2 years of the Trump administration. They didn't do anything except for tax cuts. They're not going to be able to get more tax cuts. It's not like they're setting up some type of like policy proposals for if they take the Senate and the presidency in 2 years. So it's really just about who's going to get the most bat crap crazy committee to investigate the most useless and sort of fever swampy topic.
Like Hunter Biden's nudes, which is what Marjorie Taylor Greene is angling for, as you've been saying, because people forget, like, she's been stripped of her committees and has not necessarily been able to have the power that she's wanted to have, her assignments, since the Democrats have been in control of the House for the past 4 years.
Yeah, she hasn't sat on a committee at all, never mind chaired one. And I don't think she'll end up chairing one. But when they talk about rules committee, this is what they're talking about. They're talking about, like, how do we work around seniority issues because there's somebody who's in Matt Gaetz's way and Matt Gaetz wants to have the power because then you also get the contributions and, you know, from big donors. And so that's what's going on here. And the question is, you know, what is Matt Gaetz? What does Biggs want? What do these people want in terms of their own personal fiefdom? And will it come at the expense of other Congress people who are willing to capitulate and suck it up so that Kevin McCarthy can be leader? you know, all good stuff. They'll resolve this at one point. They have to. It really doesn't make a difference whether it's Kevin McCarthy is the leader or whomever at the end of the day. But no, this is, you know, this is not a fight for any type of policy or anything like this. It's just for their individual power. And it would, I mean, it makes sense. That's what these want. It's just the funny part is that, like, what they want for their power is just to be able to be the person who comes out and says, like, I've examined Hunter Biden's dick pics. And, you know, like, there's some discrepancies that I've noticed. And that's what they're going to be talking about.
And another big thing that they want specifically in the rules, in those, like, rules changes that Scalise is talking about is they want the ability to be able to call a vote to replace McCarthy basically at any point in his term.
Which will be fantastic.
And so he's trying his absolute best to give them basically every other concession but that, because he just does not want to be in a position where he has to be like, oh, like, maybe we do need to raise the debt limit, or maybe we do need to, like, pass this bill to fund the government, because he can't be the iconoclast anymore when he's actually, like, leading the House of Representatives.
Good point. Yes, yeah. Yes. And at any moment, if they have the ability to call a vote at any moment, that means that on every single issue that comes up, they are basically going to say, like, you're either going to do what we want or we're going to have another vote. And remember, you're talking like what, a 4-seat majority, 5-seat majority? That's before you have the normal, like, sort of attrition amongst Congress people. So this should be pretty interesting going forward. And then on the same topic, we have in the Senate just passed a $1.7 trillion budget. The deal, broadly speaking, was we want an extra $50 billion for defense on top of, like, you know, we're sending $50 billion to Ukraine, but we want another $50 billion in defense, basically just to prime the pump for these big military industrial donors. And you'll get an increase in spending on the domestic side. EPA got an extra $10 billion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Still less domestically, the total that we spend.
Of course.
Than what we spend.
It's America.
Yeah, I know. I understand. But I always bring this up. Bernie Sanders' College for All plan, I think, is like $48 billion a year. So virtually identical to the increase in just 1 year to the military.
And let's be clear. That's 1 year. But that $48 billion is going to be in it next year. Mm-hmm. They're going to add to it, probably. But that's a 48. That's like taking a separate program and say, we're going to start another program. It's going to cost $50 billion a year on top of the other $800 billion that's already there. And this is on top of the extra $30 billion that the year before they added. I mean, so they have started new programs. They just call it defense, essentially. And it is. It's just defense. It's stunning. And the amount of debate that's associated with it. Now, of course, you get these Republicans who, they don't really have a problem with the defense. They have a problem with spending. And at the end of the day, it's really the thing that they would want to cut is anything on the domestic side. So you got to take that with a grain of salt. But here is Mike Lee. They are pissed because there was, what, like a dozen at least Republicans that voted for this. And, you know, it's really just a function of, like, there's a storm coming. We really want to get out of D.C. I mean, when you start to contemplate how much of the trajectory of this country is a function of, like, the plane rides that the senators have to take, it's crazy. But here's Mike Lee.
Lee, just the last point here. I mean, I think Rand Paul put his finger on it. He was on our show a couple nights ago. He said GOP has lost any power of the purse, and he said the GOP has emasculated itself. This is not a good episode for the Republican
emasculated
Party.
Itself. Pause yeah, it for a all. Second. And, incidentally, and I mean, just be clear, right? I mean, I don't. There was a time, incidentally, that I would get calls on the old Air America show with conservatives complaining about Dick Durbin wearing a pink tie because it was so emasculating.
Yeah.
And these guys are talking
Our
about
enemies are laughing at us.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what they said. Exactly. And the idea that this is emasculating, you know.
I mean, the Republican Party is a man. We know that, right? So God is a man, and so is the GOP, baby.
They've been emasculated.
Or the Republican Party, is it?
No, not at all. And in fact, I'm glad you brought up the tax hikes in there, which are themselves problematic. And you're correct to point out that they're not getting the attention they deserve. One of the reasons that this sort of thing can happen and not get much attention in the process, and Republicans can still go through the motions and vote for it.
Wait, what? Let's try that one more time.
Huh. Oddly.
Here we go.
One of the reasons that this sort of thing can happen and not get much attention in the process, and Republicans can still go through the motions and vote for it devastatingly, is because it's folded into a 4,155-page bill, one that was negotiated in secret by four or five members of Congress, held secret from the public until Tuesday morning, Larry. There's not a human alive who can digest 4,155 pages of legislative appropriations text in that short a period of time. It's one of the reasons why this should never happen. Republicans, in particular, who do this, should be asked to never, ever do it again. We will self-destruct as a party if this ever happens again.
Yeah, afraid you're right. Afraid you're right.
Yeah, I have no idea what they're talking about. I mean, it's really... But what is interesting, Is this the first... It's not the first, but it's pretty close. A budget to be passed with earmarks, because earmarks returned. I think it was a year or two ago when Biden came in.
Yes.
And earmarks makes a big difference. Big difference
in getting this stuff
passed. Yeah. I think Leahy, who sits on the Appropriations Committee, got $200 million, but
Alabama got some as well.
Yeah, got $600 million.
Yeah.
For Alabama. And that's how these things happen. And if you look at the here's Marjorie Taylor Greene talking about the 18 Republican traitors. You know, You know, I remember back when the ACA, they were saying, like, there shouldn't be a bill that is more than 10 pages long.
It's the dumbest sort of brain dead talking point. You have staffs.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
But it is the case that we're not going to know all the things that are in this until there's reporters out there. Now, let's be honest. Most Americans will never know what's in this because they don't care.
Mm.
Okay. But here, go back up to those names. They don't care what's in it. And so they're not even going to read when, you know, David Dayen at the American Prospect breaks down the things that we don't like or do like in that bill. And somebody at the new, you know, at the National Review looks at the things that they do or don't like, et cetera, et cetera. But these, Marjorie Taylor Greene talks about the 18 Republican traitors.
Yeah. Also, soy boys who are emasculating the party.
Who voted for the $1.7 trillion Omni-monster.
Omni-monster. She's trying to make that work.
I mean, your money to defend Ukraine's border, but not America's border. There is $50 billion in there. We should be clear, just so that if people get mistaken, we do not have a massive military force that is invading this country and having annexed like parts of Texas or other states, which, you know, there's an argument for something like that maybe would not necessarily be a bad thing. But
it's a bit of understated to say what is going on in Ukraine is a border issue.
Yeah, I would say that's like
a bit minimizing. It's a border dispute.
But 18 of those Republicans, I would imagine that we will have the opportunity within a matter of weeks to know exactly how much each one of those 18 Republicans were able to bring back to their state. And I would imagine it is in the, you know, 10 to 10 million minimum and up. You know, Roy Blunt may have the Roy Blunt Museum that gets named there, and you know, as people are exiting, Tom Cotton may have gotten something for like the Arkansas, you know, military treatment sewer plant or something like that named after him. There's a lot of that going on. So it's interesting dynamic that has changed. Couple of sponsors on today's program. This is great. I have I haven't gotten this yet, but I've been meaning to order this, and now I'm going to do it. One of the things I love about Quip, they're a design company that basically focuses on dental hygiene. And I love, and I think everybody knows this. I mean, obviously, I like the toothbrushes, and I chew the gum, and the mouthwash is great. That's all that's great. That's great. But their automatic, their refillable flosser is amazing.
Mm.
But I got to be honest, you know, sometimes you don't do it as much as you want. And I was told by my dentist, get a water pick. And I'm like, I'm not getting one of those things. Because you got to plug it in, and I don't want all that stuff. That's why I like the Quip toothbrush, because you don't have to plug it in.
Right.
Well, Quip is making it easy for you to stop lying to your dentist about your flossing. They have a new rechargeable cordless water flosser. It's amazing. You don't have to worry about a plug. Quip hits all the right spots with a gentle or deep clean pressure at the touch of a button. It's really easy to control. It's even easier to refill, so your countertops stay just as clean as your teeth. That's the beauty of also the Quip toothbrush. You can create a habit, but if you don't maintain it, because your toothbrush is falling off your sink, and you know, I have a tiny bathroom in my apartment. It's easy to control. It's even easier to refill. Like I say, you can really get in there. All the plaque, the popcorn, the leftover spinach. Believe me, you don't want to have to do the thing where they lift up your gums and clean up above.
Oh.
That. Yeah, no good. Jeez. Not fun. It's gone with precision thanks to a 360-degree rotating magnetic floss tip that snaps into place. The whole Quip lineup will save your mouth and keep your mouth in tip-top shape. It's left over 9 million mouths happy and healthy. Trust me, take the plunge into feel-good flossing. Go to getquip.com/majority right now for your first refill on floss tips, brush heads, and more for free. Spelled GETQUIP.com, getquip.com/majority. Plus, shop Quip's lowest prices of the year this holiday season. Quip, it's the good habits company. Check it out, folks. Also, it is the time of year where people are giving to charities. One of the charities we've featured on this program in the past has been Give Directly. I found Give Directly a couple years ago through a portal that essentially does all the research you want to be done before you donate money. And it's GiveWell. No relationship to Give Directly, except for they had just featured it a couple years ago. GiveWell spends over 30,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funding to a few of the highest impact, evidence-backed opportunities they found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate to more than $1 billion. And rigorous evidence suggests these donations are going to save over 150,000 lives. It's going to improve the lives of millions more. And here's the amazing part. Using GiveWell's research is totally free. Free to you and to the charities that you give to. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. You don't have to even sign up. And like I say, they allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund you choose without taking a cut. This is why it's great to give through GiveWell, because for the charity itself, they see no difference, and you're supporting a site that will continue to be able to do research on the most effective dollar-for-dollar charities that exist out there. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. Here's what you do. To claim your match, go to givewell.org. Pick podcast, enter the majority report with Sam Cedar at checkout. Make sure that they know that you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report so that you can get your donation matched. Check it out today. Great website, great service to people who want to figure out the best way to give this season. And lastly, final sponsor of the day is SunsetLakeSebade.com. They have a sale going on until December 31st. So it's about another 8 days, 11:59 p.m., right up into New Year's. They have they are releasing its new 2022 hemp flower. So the cultivars you know and love will be joined by Candy Kush. It's a hybrid, great for helping you to ease into bed. They have smokables, they have pre-rolls, they have buds and smalls. This is, for me, I like the pre-rolls, but you can use the smalls. And what do? Matt, you like grind it up and put it into other stuff, right?
Yeah, you put the smalls into your grinder with everything else you're grinding up, and a nice little mixture gets created.
And the beauty is Sunset Lake Sebade, as you know, majority employee-owned business, pays a minimum wage of $20 an hour. Their farm uses regenerative farming practices that they developed with the University of Vermont, like cover cropping, a crop rotation, and they grow all of their hemp without the use of harmful pesticides or synthetic fertilizers. Check it out. All of their stuff is third-party analyzed, and they have tinctures, they have fudge, they have coffee, they have gummies, all sorts of different gummies, including some with melatonin or THC. Check it out. Starting today through the end of the year, all of Sunset Lake's Sebade hemp flower will be buy one, get one free. Mix and match cultivars to find your new favorite. No promo code needed. But as always, left is best. We'll get you 20% off. Again, visit sunsetlakesebade.com to try these amazing new cultivars and take advantage of the sale while it lasts. The sale ends December 31st. I'm opening up the phone lines, folks.
Whoa.
Yep. Skippy says, show us your established tit, Lord Cedar. lettuce for Prime Minister. Can't lie to your dentist if you don't go to one. There you go. Jersey Jeff. iPhone died suddenly. Apple told me to buy a new one. Only found one guy across the country willing to repair it. Feel like I haven't heard much of the right to repair movement recently. What is stalling it? P.S. Androids sucks. The Android app sucks. We're going to be, Kyle is going to redo it by probably the beginning of the year. In the next like week, the new Android app is going to be out, and it's going to be great. Let's go to the phones. Calling from a 203 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, good afternoon, Sam, Emma, Matt, Lack, and
Bradley.
Bradley. I knew that. I'd know it better if he followed me on Twitter. Putting that aside, this is Jay. And over in New Haven, I wanted to
Jay in New Haven. Long time no hear from.
Great start, hey, Jay.
Well, it's as I say. I don't have. I'm an older man now, and it's harder for me to
you are.
Gear up to you know call in and do all of that.
Well, you can only imagine how hard it is for me to take your call. Then.
All right, I'm going to talk right into the phone now. Is that better?
Yeah, much better.
Okay. I knew this would happen. I'm driving. So I wanted to talk to you. I have a solar array on my roof with a net meter, and it's satisfactory, but I have room for more panels, and I want to generate more power. So I contracted locally, and they gave me, an estimate. But then they gave it to me after January 1st of 2022, and then I was informed that they're not going to do net meters anymore in Connecticut. And I said, well, that's okay. I already have a net meter. And they said, no, any new panels you add to your roof, you have to go through a new meter. You have to buy an additional meter, and you have to contract to sell all of the power generated from those new panels to the power company based on a 20-year contract that you have to sign. 20 years.
So you get locked in at a price.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But even though I already have a net meter, and I actually went to an attorney to say, is there a workaround here? And no. And so I went and looked up the articles, and the public utility regulatory body we have here, PURA, they made a deal a year earlier in the beginning of 2021, and they explained the reasoning that it was important to protect stakeholders in the power company who you know, might be vulnerable to people generating their own power.
By vulnerable, it just means like that some of their profits might be the enormous amount of money.
Yeah, and when they say when they say stakeholders, obviously they mean executives.
Right.
And the reason they push this through, and I suspect, is because they expect in 5 years after people sign their contracts that there are going to be a lot more electric cars getting powered up in people's garages going forward. And they're looking for a massive windfall, and they don't want people generating their own juice to power their cars. Even though if you have a solar array and you would power your car, you'd have to do it overnight in most cases for people, and there's no sun at night, so you still have
what
to
about,
power.
What about, can you get batteries?
Yeah, you would, I would, well, the thing is, if I were to do this, I would have, and I have a battery array in my basement already to, instead of a generator for when, because I live out in the woods, I'm an ex-urban guy.
All right, but, we don't need too much information, Jay, but go ahead, yeah.
No, I'm happy to share. I always post pictures of my hikes in the woods to you guys and show the wildlife out here.
Great.
But putting that aside, yeah, you can do that, but you have to make a commitment to collect all your own power that you're generating. Whereas with a net meter, if you have excess power, you just get it knocked off your bill.
Right.
Every month. But now they've arranged it so I would have to have like 3 meters on my house, and all the power, you know, I have to kick back.
This is why we should nationalize these power companies and make this, you know, so that each state can't do this type of like shenanigans. It's ridiculous.
Well, also when they are always putting it upon us, you know, consumers have to be the ones to guard against, you know, using too much power and all of that. And when we try to do that, they say, well, hold on. And not only that, but it actually undermines not just me, but anybody who's an electrician selling solar arrays, you know, they're screwed.
Yep.
You know, they're selling a damaged goods now. So it has a...
This is just Connecticut, let's be clear, right?
As far as I know, it's just our PURA here.
All right. Well.
But it's been niggling at me and bothering me all
year.
I decided to wait.
I appreciate the call.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, Jay, wait. Let me take your time.
I got 5 minutes.
One more sec.
Anyway,
Merry Christmas and happy Hanukkah to all of you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Happy New Year.
See you on the other side.
All right.
Folks.
Thanks. We got to keep it. We do 5 minutes for every call.
Yeah. Well.
That are specifically about like, you know, one sort of like narrow thing, you know, and God bless Jay. Glad to hear from him.
It's actually a helpful call because I literally was having a conversation with a family member last night who lives in Connecticut saying they wanted to get solar. So, I mean,
in that instance, yes.
I might direct them to this. So thank you, Jay.
Yep. Matt, I am saying I was listening to both MR and Pac-Man clips on the way to drop my one-year-old daughter to daycare this week. Here's her feedback. When Pac-Man is on, my daughter cried. When she heard Sam's voice, she immediately fell asleep. That put a W in the Sam column, if you call that a win. I do. Believe me. Utility is a huge part of the show. Use us as you will. Calling from a 646 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi. This is Aaron calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, everyone.
Aaron from Madison, Wisconsin. What's on your mind?
So I just had a question about the implications of Moore v. Harper. You can imagine being in Wisconsin. I'm a little nervous about it.
Yep.
So I was trying to think of a possible way out. And what I was wondering is, so we have this big state Supreme Court election coming up. If we are able to manage to flip the seats, theoretically, would then we be able to redraw at least the maps for the state legislature? So then
the best protection against, and this is the independent state legislature theory case, where when the Constitution says the legislatures get to decide every aspect of the federal government. There is this sort of outlier theory that that just means literally the legislative body, as opposed to the system of government that we have in these states because of the way that it existed at the time of the Constitution. So, yes, I don't know the specifics in Wisconsin, if you guys will be able to redraw the maps. Part of it might also do, you have a big election. I think it's in April for the Supreme Court in Wisconsin, which is hugely important.
I was going to say the primary is even more important since there's two Republicans and two Democrats. So there's a potential if we don't show up February 21st that.
So it's like it's a jungle primary because it's theoretically nonpartisan. And
very annoying.
So people should make sure they vote for that. But yes, it's always good to control the state house, without a doubt. I don't know the specifics, particularly with how the state Supreme Court could rule. I don't know how the federal government, the federal Supreme Court is going to rule, but yes, win state houses. That should always just be, that's the first step. I don't know if it'll be protection, but it'll certainly go a long way. The legislature is not going to it's not going to mess. A Democratic controlled legislature is going to do its best to gerrymander in favor of Democrats. Republicans are going to do the same. Appreciate the call.
Right, because there's so much. Okay.
Gonna jump. Let's play this.
Okay.
Talk about really disturb the kids. Rand Paul, so concerned with government waste, has his employees or himself, incidentally, he gets paid by the taxpayers. I just want you to know this.
Oh, so this is their money going to good use.
Yes. He'll complain about a study about the owls in, whatever, mm-hmm. in Washington State or something like that, that'll end up being actually sort of like relevant to our environment and important to maintain the health of species. But when it comes to him spending his senatorial time or his staffer's time on coming up with this dumb limerick, essentially, this is one of the most embarrassing things. You wonder why Rand Paul gets beat up. And really, the real question is, why doesn't he get beat up more by his neighbors?
Look at that smug mug. Sorry, this is not in the holiday spirit, but like, woof.
I don't know these things because I'm Jewish. I never really, we didn't like, but is this like a tradition where you put your own words in this? And also, is he saying it wrong? Because it doesn't sound like any of it like fits, but.
This is not a tradition, I don't think.
Oh, God. Listen to this.
'Twas the week before Christmas, and through the Senate and House, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The earmarks were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The senators were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of pork danced in their heads.
Pause it. Okay, this is what's driving me crazy. Like, danced in their heads, or... quiet as a mouse. Like
they barely change anything.
Aren't you supposed to? Well, first off, they barely change anything. But isn't there supposed to be a rising intonation at the end of these things? Not like sort of like a I can't believe I'm doing this. This is really depressive. Like not even a mouse.
Yes, you're supposed to be a little bit whimsical.
A creature was stirring. Not even a mouse like that.
As opposed to not even a mouse.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's...
It deflated.
Yeah, it's like, he seems so defeated at the end of all these limericks. Like, I can't believe I made it through this one. It's so bad.
And it's also, if it's meant to be, like, skewering government spending, I don't understand why the tone of it is in the spirit of, like, this whimsical Christmas poem. It doesn't make any sense.
Also, how about not wasting government funds on doing this, you ding-dong?
This is called pork.
It was the night before Christmas, and can you believe these Dems?
Here we go.
Was found just mischief and debt, while the taxpayers hung their poor heads and wept. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, senators sprang from their oxygen. What was the matter? Away to the window they flew like a flash, tore open the shutters when they heard the word cash. The moon on the breast of the new fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below. When what to my wondering eyes should appear? But a 4,000-page omni with endless debt year after year. With a little old driver, so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be Saint Nick. More rapid than eagles, his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now McConnell, now Schumer, now Pelosi and Vixen.
Oh, here we go.
On Biden, on stupid, on dumber and Blitzen.
What?
To debt, they to bankruptcy, to free money for all. Now dash away, more cash for all. And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As the economy threatened to run aground, down the chimney, St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of earmarks he had flung on his back, an appropriator's dream opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled.
Pause it. I will say this. I do appreciate the fact that Santa is a villain in this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a villain. He's a villain. Christmas is an evil thing, he's saying. And,
more
you
cash.
Know, I can sort of get behind that a little bit. I guess the idea is he's trying to make it seem like the economy is going to crash because of the $1.7 trillion appropriations.
Yeah, that's
we've never been able to, draw that. We've never quite been able to connect those two things. That's never happened. Although, if you look back at every time we have had a recession, it has been either a function of the private sector over-leveraged, right, like the financial crisis, or we have come too close to having a surplus in the government budget. Because we know this from Stephanie Kelton, when the government has a surplus, there's a fixed amount of money. I mean, it can grow, but at any given moment, there's a fixed amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a government surplus, that means that there's less money in the private sector. If there's a government debt, that means that there's more money in the private sector. That's it.
Yeah, it's like people react to the spending bills like, it's making this library in this X town. It's like, yeah, who do you think that money's going to pay? It's going into people's pockets.
There's going to be librarians, and then people are going to be able to go to the library.
Like the people are going to build it. Like,
yeah.
The issue with the money that goes to the defense manufacturers and defense industry, it's not that the money is being spent. It's that it's going into the wrong hands. It's going into very wealthy people's hands. And to the extent that it's doing anything, it's building stuff that will add really no, they are almost like definitionally non-investments in the future. Because when they get deployed, they explode and leave nothing but destruction.
Yeah. And also the money that goes to the Pentagon, we have no real oversight as to where it goes. The Pentagon's been audited multiple times, and they fail every single time on like where they allocate that money.
But he also has a problem with it going to anything that helps people, too. But let's listen to two more, like maybe not even a minute, another 20 seconds.
This is tough.
We're not even halfway done.
I know. I can't believe it.
When I saw that it was over 4 minutes on the sound, I took a deep breath.
There's about 30 seconds that's just like a disclaimer at the end.
How many people do you think in the world, got through all 3.5, 4 minutes of this?
Like the 8 people on the staff.
You did?
Yeah,
it's his job.
I had to watch.
Somebody's bucking for like hazard pay.
Dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses. His nose like a cherry. This spending season, instead of naughty and nice, Santa brought everyone something, regardless of price. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head, he said not to worry. There's always the Fed. He spoke not a word.
Okay,
this is demonic this is like, Santa.
His tone is like a guy who like walks into the ocean afterwards.
I don't understand this. I just don't understand like the inclination. I don't understand like the theory.
It's content,
behind it.
Baby. Just get some content out there.
And it just hits different after the pandemic when they actually did hand out cash and people really liked it.
Unbelievable.
Free cash for all sounds really good, actually.
Yeah, it does.
Thames Darwin writes, Sam, don't know if you're taking IMs today, but I'd like a shofar for my former father-in-law, an old lefty from way back who died yesterday at 92, a Jewish son of immigrants. He grew up in a house in which cell meetings for the Communist Party were routinely held. As a merchant seaman, he helped to unionize his crew. By the age of 25, he'd set foot on five continents. The last 15-plus years, he bravely fought leukemia. Though my marriage to his daughter has ended, I'm a better person for having known him. That's a nice
thought. Lovely.
Call him from a 415 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Amy.
Oh, hi,
from
Amy.
Amy
from San Francisco. What's on your mind?
Well, the usual, you know, love you guys. You're wonderful. I've been listening to you, Sam, since God was a boy.
I wanted to,
Emma, your girl crush, Kelsey Gabbard. I heard this other podcast.
Mike Prizner. QAnon
Anonymous.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Mike Prizner was talking about this.
He was on QAnon Anonymous, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, she's like, you always say that she looks like she's in a cult or a cult leader. She was. She grew up in this cult.
Yeah, no,
cult.
I don't say that just to be, I guess, mean. There was a whole piece in the lead up to the primary. I believe it was New York Magazine. Let me just check that you might enjoy. I think it is, yeah, New York Magazine, where they detail it, came out in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, and it seems like the major tenet of this cult is just homophobia.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You know, Michael was on this very, very, very early and would talk about this extensively. And, of course, you know, she pretended like she had some type of reformation for a while. There was like an 18-month period where Gabbard sort of like downplayed this.
Sorry for all that thing where I started my political career helping my dad try to take rights away from gay people.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, like a salmon, she has come home, essentially.
Well, it was probably the plan all along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not...
She couldn't come in swinging at gay folks. I don't know.
I'm not convinced of that.
Party.
I'm not convinced of that. I think reversion was easy. And maybe she never got that far. I don't buy that was the plan all along. Like, you'd have to be almost more insane to think that that's a workable plan than I think she probably is on some level. So I think that she tried to do it one way and then realized I couldn't. And she just pivoted back because that was also just the easier thing to do. And in many respects, she may be now not even having to, you know, it may be more natural for her where she is now with this stuff. But there was some obvious like sort of signposts that she was being a little bit disingenuous over the years. So,
and that in that QAnon Anonymous episode, it's a two-parter with Mike Prizner, goes into the way Tulsi was sort of taught or what have you about sex growing up. And it's interesting context for her saying there should be no public education about mm-hmm. sex. She's not maybe the person we should be taking cues from.
Well, we were just talking about Mike, because Mike Prizner also interviewed a former prisoner from Guantanamo Bay who claims that Ron DeSantis was there doing some of the torturing. And I mean, we know he was there as a JAG representative, but what role he played, you know, I haven't, you know, I'm going to be digging into that over vacation. And I think Mike is somebody that we may have on the program in a couple of months when we get on the other side of 2023. But yeah, we'll talk more about Tulsi. But, you know, and I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for calling in.
But read that piece by Carrie Howley. I'm not sure if the podcast covers it, but it's very good. What'd you say, Matt?
Thanks. Okay. The podcast is in.
Happy New Year.
Crazy stuff on it.
Thank you. All right.
All right.
I will listen to that QAnon Anonymous podcast as well.
Smedley, thanks for a great year, MR crew. Looking forward to more greatness in the new year. Left is best. Vegan Marks, happy Friday, MR crew. Always a treat to listen and watch live. Solidarity to the workers for having to brave this winter storm. Stay safe and revolutionary all. Small man. Hi, crew. Oh, no, Sam's mailman. Hi, crew. Didn't see any war on Christmas narrative this year. Is that just because I've checked out from right-wing media? Have the right wing just moved on? Will it be back? Or did Trump just make Merry Christmas again? You know, I think what's missing from this is...
a black president.
That certainly helps. Although we saw it during the Bush years. I think part of what's also inhibiting the narrative is that we now have a Supreme Court that is literally carving out from all sorts of laws these exceptions if you religiously don't want to participate in American society. So it's sort of harder to argue.
But maybe, they go all in on Christmas. Like I was in Midtown last night and I drove past News Corp and the whole like freaking building outside, it's like green and red and Christmas advertisements. It's really bizarre, but I don't know.
Northern Spy, hey Sam and MR crew, can I please? Can I get a shofar in honor of my grandfather who passed away recently? He was a huge Red Sox fan who grew up in Connecticut, made sure none of his grandkids rooted for the dreaded Yankees. Great man who I'll miss dearly, but I know I will carry with me going forward. Yes. Red Sox Nation. Red Sox Nation. Which one of these should we do before we get to Matthew Film Guy?
There's some good. We could do the thing on the post office, number four.
Oh yeah, let's do that. Yeah. We announced the other day that the Biden administration basically got in the post office to begin over the next couple of years to buy a majority of its new cars that it was adding, trucks that it was adding to its fleet to be electric. And then by 2026, all new cars or vehicles, I should say, purchased by the post office should be electric. This is a big deal because the post office has the largest fleet of vehicles in the world. And not only will converting them all to electric, and it'll take years before they're all, right? Because we're just talking about new purchases as these other existing vehicles drop off. But in the next 2 years alone, I think they're talking over 100,000 electric vehicles. And then by 2026, I imagine it's closer to like close to 200,000 electric vehicles. And that number's going to continue because there's a certain amount that they, you know, pull off the road each year. That will mean more charging stations. That will mean greater development of infrastructure. That will mean more money in the electric car industry. It'll mean more innovation in that industry, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that originally was supposed to be the idea is that it was also going to mean more union jobs working on this. But the Biden administration seems to have fallen down on this one again, the union question. Here is a question from AOC of Victoria Stefan, the executive director for the Next Gen Delivery Vehicles for the U.S. Postal Service. On April 5th, 2022, this was the House Oversight Committee hearing.
Ms. Stevens, are you aware that the announcement that Next Generation Delivery Vehicle Fleet would be built in South Carolina after the Oshkosh Defense initially won the contract in having facilities in Wisconsin?
Yeah, the Postal Service was made aware of that decision shortly before the public announcement, and it is a decision that's at the discretion of the supplier.
So are you aware?
It's buffering.
Wisconsin?
Yeah, the Postal Service was made aware of that decision shortly before the public announcement, and it is a decision
What's
that's
going
at
on?
The discretion
can we put,
of
can
the
put
supplier.
This up?
Let's refresh it, maybe. Twitter's probably pretty buggy right now.
We got
to
download.
Are you aware that the announcement that Next Generation Delivery Vehicle Fleet would be built in South Carolina after the Oshkosh defense initially won the contract in having facilities in Wisconsin?
Yeah, the Postal Service was made aware of that decision shortly before the public announcement, and it is a decision that's at the discretion of the supplier.
So are you aware that Oshkosh Defense might be trying to circumvent its longstanding contract with the United Auto Workers workforce in Wisconsin by essentially building a brand new facility after the contract was awarded in a vacant warehouse?
Hold on, pause it. Wait, what are we doing? Are we going to put it up or not?
I have no awareness of
just I don't understand. Well, okay, we got to just decide. If the audio is going, just leave it up. All right, let's go to a break, and let's get Matthew in, and then we'll do this afterwards, okay?
because I.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is the final Friday of the year, and that we're going to be live.
Mm.
And what better way to celebrate it? And I'm going to have a full week, so I'm going to watch some movies. I don't know about you. And
idea.
Who better to have this guy on?
Matthew, the film guy, is Cassavetes on Netflix and other such things.
Oh, my God. Day drinking.
Making me thirsty.
10 a.m. in L.A.?
Whoa, Matthew Film Guy, rocking the Jazz Daredevil whiskey highball. You gotta be careful, because the report I've gotten back from everybody on this is that too strong packs a bit of a punch, and it is now 1:05 p.m. on Eastern Standard Time. That means it's
10 a.m.
in the Pacific. You're
going to need a nap, Matthew.
I'm in New York, so it's fine. It's 1:05.
It's afternoon. Mm. And
listen, these are better drinks than John is a piano player. I'll just put it to you that way. So there, I can definitely recommend them.
People really enjoy it. The shipping is a little bit high, a little bit expensive to ship it. But if you're in New York,
you West 13th Street. You can go there.
You can buy them on West 13th Street in the city.
There's a guy in an alley.
There's a guy in an alley. Matthew Film Guy. This is actually like like not just it's apropos because it's the end of the year and we love to have you on, and you're one of the, you know, we have a couple of regs on Fridays that we have on. You are probably the most consistent one we've had on for years. But you didn't make it into the best of. So this is sort of like the beginning of the best of. You're the first. You're the first of the best of guests. Really, is what it is.
Andy Kindler couldn't make it, could he?
Mm.
Kindler actually could not make it. No, he could not make it.
You can always count on me, Sam.
But it was perfect timing because there's a scandal brewing, and in some ways, you're in the middle of it.
You know what?
Slight exaggeration.
Wow. Yes,
I would love to think that I was right smack dab in the middle of it, but believe me, I have been enjoying every minute of the fallout around the latest Sight and Sound poll, which if
okay,
you are
so you're
going
to start with what is the Sight and Sound poll and then go into, right. You know, your favorite film of all time.
Right. You know, I know the inverted pyramid. I'm no Matt Taibbi. I know how to lead a story. If you're not familiar, Sight and Sound is the magazine put out by the British Film Institute since the early 50s. And every 10 years, they put out what they consider, or what a lot of people have considered, the definitive list, if you believe in lists, of the greatest 100 movies of all time. Now, granted, lists are silly, ultimately, but they're great for having conversations about what makes great film. And this year, for the first time...
Well, and let me add something to that, too. They also... people go to these lists to see what they should watch.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so it also develops the culture because people go and they assume these are the best movies. They watch these movies to the extent that they want to become more sophisticated about the way they assess movies. They assess it based upon... the structures that have determined that these movies are good. I mean, this is not, you know, I mean, it's not the end of the world one way or another, but it is part of the world.
No, and it's pretty awesome because this year the controversy stemmed originally around, they actually hired Sight and Sound, a polling consultant who is a film programmer and sort of a major film guy, who decided that it would be better to broaden the number of people who vote. Now, it went from like, I don't know, a few dozen people in 1952 to in 2012, I think it was like a hundred and something or a couple hundred. This year, it was like 1,600. So they vastly increased the amount of people who were being asked to vote on this. And the results were pretty interesting. While it's not nearly as shocking as I think the furor, the tempest in a teapot amongst the film guy crowd has made it, the thing that I'm the most pleased about is that after years of Citizen Kane, which I'm sure you've heard of, being number one, and Vertigo sort of jockeying for first and second, a film by Chantal Ackerman called Jean Dielman, which I've been a very vocal proponent of for many years since I saw it at the Museum of the Moving Image in the early 2000s, shot to number one after being, I think, in the 20s or something in the previous year, and not being on the poll even the previous one to that. And a lot of people, some prominent filmmakers, have decried this as a woke reappraisal because she is a female director. Mm-hmm. The movie itself happens to be extremely concerned with females' issues. Although, listen, I've never considered myself the wokest man on the planet, and I have been a huge fan of this film just for what it does to your consciousness. Yes, it is about a housewife doing tedious housework for 3 hours, but what it does to your brain is far more to me compelling than the content. Now, the content is definitely compelling and interesting and unique, but I feel like this woke, this, you know, cry of woke is just another result of this sort of knee-jerk cultural war that we're undergoing right now, and it has seeped into this. Now, I understand why some people may have felt that this was a kind of cinematic affirmative action, if you will, because the guy who did this poll, this consultant, did tweet out that he wanted to set the white male canon on fire. And I'm doing this a lot because to the extent that he had any ability to control the results, it was simply in the number of people and the kinds of people that he invited to vote. But to me, the answer to this question is not that there's been a thumb put on the scale, but in some ways the thumb has been taken off the scale. And it's been expanded to include people with other points of view. Now, for me, I am not ever, and I've never been, a sort of cultural studies film guy. Like, I don't think that simple diversity of representation is valuable per se. But what I think it does give you is the ability to see the world through other people's eyes and really start to broaden your own understanding of the world. It doesn't need to, you know, you can see a film directed by a woman that's just as misogynistic and sort of limited and classically whatever made as any man. And I've seen films made by men that were just as unique and worthwhile and interesting and sensitive as, you know, any minority. So to me, this is not really a relevant issue. And I could see how you wouldn't want a film poll to be subject to quotas or something like that. But I don't think the answer to why some of these films, which also include other favorites like Killer of Sheep, made by Charles Burnett, a black filmmaker, that moved up the list. Wanda, made by Barbara Loden, another female filmmaker, that moved up the list. The thing that people aren't getting, unfortunately, in this sort of cultural war tempest, is that these movies were not actually available on home movie for very many years. They were unseeable. And in the past 10, 15 years, these movies have actually been able to be seen. Now, I think that is a function of they were neglected, they were low budget, they were made by minorities, they were also not necessarily the most commercial films, even amongst what is considered the best movies of all time. Like Citizen Kane is an entertaining movie, no matter who you are, really. And Vertigo really is, too. These were commercial movies in that strictest sense. So these movies got actually seen. And to the extent that it was from some sort of, attempt to be sort of more diverse, that's only good in that it brings in more points of view and more artistic insights. Because to me, the art is the most important thing here, not the sociology, not the representation. But if you're really interested in looking into this, there was a horrible piece that is basically the worst piece written on it by a guy named Armand White. I don't know if you're familiar with him, Sam. He's basically the Tucker Carlson of film criticism. He's got the worst take on it. But there's another piece in The New Yorker by a woman named Jennifer Winter, who I thought nailed why Jean Dielman deserves the number one spot. It is absolutely a masterpiece. And to me, I actually never had been a huge fan of Citizen Kane or Vertigo. I think they're well-made films, but they have a very limited kind of Hollywood style view of life. And even though they're super competent in that realm.
All right. Well, let's hold on for one second. We'll get to the actual sort of like the list and the merits of the list in a second. But let's just stay on this topic of the of the controversy surrounding it, because it has like some whiffs of like Gamergate. There's some of that in this, and it's also like it's sometimes it's easier, I think, to sort of look at these questions of like wokeness and woke pushback and et cetera, in the context of this, as opposed to our politics, because the politics get a little bit more complicated. The point you made about we're really, this isn't about putting the thumbs on the scale for certain movies. It is taking the thumbs off the scale that have been there. Aside from the fact that, like, you mentioned Vertigo and
Citizen Kane.
Very hard to get funding for movies in general. Back then, impossible if you were a woman or a person of color. Literally impossible to make a studio-backed film. Just not. We have examples of zero number of people who did it other than white males. So that is sort of like a structural thumb on the scale. But again, if you're just looking at the movies, never mind how they get made, because, you know, when you make a movie, you can't put a little scroll under the screen like, oh, it rained on that day, and that's why we didn't get the scene we wanted. Or you have no idea how problematic my producer was on this day, and that's why we did it. Or, you know, I shouldn't have cast that person because they didn't, you know, they were drunk when they showed up. You can't do that.
These things all happen to you, right, Sam?
Well, actually. But the idea that that system has perpetuated and made it harder to access, that occurs to me. And the other thing that occurs to me is, I don't know if you remember this, but I think it was in like the 80s. I think it was Billboard when they were starting to like with the, there was a like overnight Billboard went from when computers started to roll in. Maybe this was in the 90s. Instead of assessing the top 10 songs or albums of the week or the month or whatever it was, by surveying, you know, the Strawberries, I think it was, that would sell the records in, you know, the top 10 cities. They were computerized, and so they could assess what was selling across the entire country. And all of a sudden, overnight, it went from like Phil Collins is number one to rap became number one, because we started to realize, like, oh my God, rap is not, you know, is not just being listened to in urban centers and barely there. It's actually like all of these kids in the suburbs are listening to it as well. And overnight, it changed that, and by democratizing the, which you do as you add more people to voting for these things, you get, you suddenly realize like we've taken it from this very cloistered world that is self-fulfilling and expanded it.
Now, listen, I also don't want to say that I think that there should be some sort of gatekeeping, if that's the word you want to use, to understand that this poll is not just a popularity contest. It is, so to speak, popularity contest amongst these critics. But I do believe that people who spend their lives studying, thinking, using, creating, analyzing film, those people's opinions is who you want to make a Sight and Sound poll. It shouldn't just be open the floodgates and whatever's the most, like if you look at the IMDb.
Well, that's what the box office is. So we don't need that. We don't need that. We don't need everybody voting on it.
There are those lists. They're, like I said, IMDb or Letterboxd Top 100. They're a little different. But, you know, so I do think there is something to be said for maintaining a sort of integrity of, you know, insight or expertise, if you will, for a Sight and Sound poll. So if the criticism is allayed to it that it's just, well, now anybody can vote to it, I would agree that's not a good thing. But I don't see any evidence that that is what is happening. It's just that there is a wider variety of ways of thinking about film and understanding film that is being tapped into now. It's, to me, saying Citizen Kane is the greatest movie of all time is one of the most retrograde things that could possibly happen every year. It's, you know, it's boring. It's I think it's a hollow film. Ultimately, it's entertaining and it's a lot of a sound and fury signifying nothing, especially compared to some of the other films that have come onto the list. You know, another thing is this list got a lot of sort of more recent films on it. And I may even agree, like, it's too soon to say that Get Out is one of the top 100 films of all time, or some of these other more recent ones. So I'm sort of in the middle of this debate, like, but I don't think that there's anything valuable to just assigning this as this simply a woke kind of attempt to culture war cinema. Because, again, if you get more people thinking about movies, you will get more kinds of movies. And like you said, it was hard to make movies back then. John Dale was made in 1975, did not even come out in America, didn't even get a release until 1983. And then it never even got a home movie release until 2007. And that was only on a French import DVD. And then finally, I think Criterion put it out in 2017 or something like that. So it's been a long haul for this kind of a movie. And I just want to be clear, it's not just because it was made by a woman. It is a very rigorous movie. It is a difficult movie under the best circumstances to watch. You really have to pay attention to the things that are going on in this movie over its 3.5 hours almost. So it is asking a lot of the audience. And that is, to me, the antithesis of a commercial prospect. You know, a commercial movie is telling the audience, here, check this out. Go, come along for a ride. Turn off your brain. And in a way, Citizen Kane is just a perfect example of that, even though it's got pretensions of greatness to its themes and its sort of technique was innovative. It's still a movie that is anyone I think could watch and enjoy. You have to be committed to watch movies like Jean Dielman, even like Killer of Sheep or Wanda or some of the other newer entries onto this list. And I think these lists are good for telling people, hey, these are worth the effort. And the fact that they are made by a woman or minorities to me is sort of beside the point.
But
we just say he's also one of the most passive aggressive film critics? I mean, you were laughing at like when he's like, turn off your brain and like.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm appreciative of it because I mean, look, I like Citizen Kane, right? But I think that there is this reticence by some people to critique movies like that from the way that you are like speaking about it, Matthew, because I don't emotionally resonate with Citizen Kane, right? I don't think a lot of women emotionally resonate with a ton of movies that have been, that were made in the golden age of cinema. Just because the female characters in those films, and it's just like not even black representation or non-white representation during that period either, but they're really caricatures of how men want them, or wanted to have them portrayed. And so it makes me feel uncultured sometimes when I don't resonate with Vertigo or with Citizen Kane in the same way, because that's what the lists all say I need to be, you know, appreciating in the same way. And it doesn't feel that way for me.
But didn't the mom get him the sled?
Yeah, that's important. Right. That is important. You're right.
I mean, honestly, Vertigo may be the most male gaze movie ever made, right? Mm-hmm. It's about a guy who thinks this one woman is this other woman. He's staring at women all the time. It's all about his looks at these women. And, I mean, it's like really, if you wanted to have a time capsule of that kind of filmmaking, that is it. But to me, it's not even that part of it. It's they are limited in even more ways than that. This kind of very heady, you know, the film critic who I love, Ray Carney, calls it visionary filmmaking, where it's all about looking and it's all about seeing and it's all about understanding people's emotions just from the way the shot is framed and the lighting and the music. And it's all very sort of spoon-fed in this little shorthanded way. And that takes talent, that takes craft, and my hat is off to those people for making these compelling movies. But even just the film language that these other movies that I'm talking about use, you may attribute it to their sort of marginal cultural status or their sort of whatever you want to call their demographics, or they're just geniuses. You know, it could be one or the other. And to me, that is the crux of the conversation. And I also should be fair to say some of the best top tens that are repeated on there are also ones that are maybe not in this mode, like Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game. I think that is this is sort of a humanist sort of strain to the greatest films of all time that have been around. Also, Tokyo Story is often at the top by Ozu. I think those movies are much more or let's say much less a boys club kind of a movie, just because they're more sensitive visions of life.
I think what you were saying, Matthew, it can be a male director that makes female characters empathetic. One of my favorite movies of the past 20 years was Carol, and that was made by Todd Haynes. And I think that's like one of the best, you know, like most emotionally resonant movies that I've seen in my life.
Have you seen Todd Haynes' movie Safe? That could be.
No.
You've never seen Safe?
I've never seen Safe. I know I need to go through, like, I still also haven't seen the Big Splash. Was that him? Or no, that's Guadagnino. Never mind, actually.
Safe could be on my top 10 of all time if I ever get asked for the Sight and Sound poll, which, you know, let's not kid ourselves.
And but, Splash also was great with Tom Hanks.
I was thinking of Guadagnino, but I do want to see Far From Heaven. I still haven't seen either, so I need to go through good. Todd Haynes.
Far From Heaven was a sort of pastiche of Douglas Sirk's movies that he made in the 50s with Rock Hudson and Jane Wyman and all those people. That you could also say that those were very artistically daring movies within the studio system at that time, made by a man, you know, with concern. They were called women's pictures even at the time. Mm. But I love all of those too.
I don't think Splash was terribly good in terms of like its representation of women. Daryl Hannah did a great job.
Well, she wasn't a woman.
She was playing a mermaid.
Yeah.
And John Candy was also great. And, you know, Eugene Levy was very funny in it. I mean, we're not talking about that.
But let's just say this. John Dielman is a movie that you really have to be locked in to see. And I've been spreading the gospel about it for many, many years. I've never said to people like, there's this great woman filmmaker. She's also Jewish. She's also Belgian. There's all these ways to categorize her. She is just was. She's passed away now, sadly. But she was just a genius filmmaker with the courage of her convictions that made a movie that expanded the boundaries of what cinema could basically do. She did build on the shoulders of giants, like maybe people like Bresson and Ozu, but she just had this vision. Even she made this movie when she was 25, that just was unique, and it took courage. And yeah, it was sort of like lightning in a bottle. You could say what you want also about the Belgian Film Commission and how they supported the public arts then. But I don't know if you people recall, but a couple years ago, I actually took the liberty of making some memes about John Dielman, and they got name-checked in one of the New Yorker articles about how John Dielman has entered the popular culture. And Sam, do you
recall? This is exciting. I vaguely do remember this. It's exciting because you could be the only person in the world who did this. Memes about John Dielman.
I mean, listen, this has been the part of the giddiness for me is that I believe that I am. And it just means that the culture is catching up to my highly refined yet somewhat absurd sense of humor. And whenever that can happen for you, you have to feel really good about what you've been doing and what you've added to the popular consciousness.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to put some of these images up. So you started off with like, this is the meme, right? Right here?
That's a scene from the movie. That's John Dielman doing her housework and making coffee. And so, you know, the first couple I did were like putting other people in there. And,
but wait,
you know,
but isn't that the meme? Like,
no.
definitionally, the meme is that the first image that exists. That's the meme. And then you fit different things into it.
I don't know about that. But
Well, the meme template, maybe.
Well, the meme template is the meme.
And actually, that's not the exact image. I just put that, gave you that for reference. But let's scroll through a few of these.
All right. So then Matthew, a film guy, did this.
And this was the one that they noted because obviously the Bernie meme went everywhere.
Right. There you go.
But I'm probably more proud of some of these other ones just because they're even more absurd.
Put this. And that's from Predator, if I'm not mistaken.
Good one, Sam.
Yeah, that's his face from Predator. And this next one is me with Tim Pool.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You recognize yourself in that one. I guess there's two then. Yeah.
Thanos.
Yes, that's
Thanos.
That's right.
Yeah, and there's me. Was this one out there? I didn't remember this. This must have been out
there.
Oh.
There you go. That's the one I'm the most proud of. If anybody, you really, this talk about a niche amongst a niche. If you understand and appreciate that one, you are one of my people.
Right. I mean, it literally, I think it's just, it's you. You're not just right. one of your people. You're
it's
you.
A meme for, it's a meme for you.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. Maybe one of you guys can get on board.
I feel like some of my best work, it basically fits those parameters where it's just like, only I get it. That's mm-hmm. it. But that's,
well,
that's,
it went from only me to, you know, a couple dozen people now. So,
I got. Let's get this one framed. Maybe you got to send this one over to me. I'll get frame this one.
Yeah, we can put it up on the wall.
All right. Yeah, I think so. And you know, listen, I recommend people try to seek out John Dielman, but I definitely also want to prepare you. It's the kind of movie that if you can see it in the theater and in New York, it's been playing now because of the sort of hype around it. It that requires you to sort of focus in and not be distracted and not try to reach for your phone when something doesn't seem to be happening. Because for the first 90 minutes, it's sort of training you to understand what's going on in this woman's world. And I don't even want to give any too many spoilers because it's sort of part of what's great is I'll just say this, that it gets to the point where audiences I've been with have been so locked in that when she's making a meatloaf, and she's almost knocks over the milk bottle. I've heard the audience gasp like it was like Freddy Krueger coming out with his claw about to kill people. So it really, really alters your consciousnesses, which is kind of my favorite thing a movie can do, apart from a story, apart from the insight into character and all that other stuff. Mm. But it is a rigorous movie. And to me, it deserves its role as number one, quite beyond any sort of accusations of woke reappraisal. So Paul Schrader, sorry, bud. I think you're wrong on this one.
Well, Matthew Film Guy, this was a great way to leave 2022 and head into 2023. Because I have a feeling these type of things are, you know, are going to be continue in our culture for a while. These type of arguments and, of course, great movie. Only other thing I wanted to say was, you know, from Bear, but what was the name of that movie that you edited?
Black Bear.
The name of the actress?
Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah, saw her in White Lotus. She was great.
She's having a moment.
Yeah, she was really fantastic in that. I hope Black Bear gets more attention because of it.
I think it will. I think that movie will have a long tail, if you will.
Nice.
Unlike Black Bears.
Oh!
Nice. Nice.
I love zoological puns.
Matthew Film Guy, let me just say thank you so much for not just all the times you've come on the show this year or last year or the year before that or the many, many years in which you have come on this program and enlightened people. I know a lot of our listeners have signed up for your YMCA film appreciation class, or I can't remember where it is these days, but
they
now
call
it's
it in Common Points Queens Center, and the new classes are enrolling now starting in the first week of January.
And you could do this via Zoom, right? I mean, it's all
that's
Zoom
right.
now.
It's all Zoom. Plenty
that's
of
fantastic.
Have joined.
Yeah.
You can go follow me on Twitter and you can see the link there, or follow me on Letterboxd at Langdon Boom. If you want to talk movies more with me, I'm always happy to hash it all out and really revel in the greatness of cinema. So it's been my pleasure, Sam, really. Anytime, any place, you know, I'll be there. And all also, right. Matt, I'm looking forward to seeing you at the live show, not to dox myself, but...
your assassination coordinates are now on display.
Ban me, but I look
You're
forward to
forward
seeing
to just seeing Matt? Is that, is
yeah.
that,
well,
is that what
yeah,
it is?
I understand that you and Sam will be there too, but... your guests, so I sort of spoke to the one running. Mm.
I'll be monopolizing the guests' attention and, you know, sort of cordoning you guys off from each other so you can't sort of, you know, talk about fees and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's-
we will put links to all of Matthew's lists and Twitter in the podcast and YouTube description. Matthew Film Guy, happy Hanukkah. Have a great new year.
Thanks, Sam. Same to you.
You
and,
too.
Yes. There he is. Look at his hitting the... hitting the what do you call it?
Jazz Daredevil.
Hard. That can be dangerous. Freebie Friday.
Oh yes. Yeah.
So,
gotta be.
All right, let's do this this clip of AOC and then we'll get back to the phones. This is relevant now because we just got the announcement of the changes in the Postal Service, essentially postal truck fleet. And that is going to be over the next 2 years. There are going to be, when they replace their vehicles, something like 100,000 of the close to 200,000 vehicles, maybe like closer to 180,000, 170,000 vehicles will be electric. So they're making this transition. Again, Postal Service has the biggest fleet of vehicles in the world. And so this is a big deal. By 2026, all their new vehicles will be electric, which means that we're going to see implications in terms of infrastructure around the country. We're going to see changes in terms of capacity to build the electric vehicles. We're going to see development of technology through the building of these vehicles. And one thing that we will not see, at least as of April, and there's no reason to believe this is different, AOC at the time basically made it clear that the company that is delivering these vehicles could have done it in Wisconsin, in their headquartered, where their headquarters are, but instead they're doing it in South Carolina, I believe it is,
yeah,
where they don't have unionized work. And this is going to become an issue. And this is also another opportunity, blown opportunity by the Biden administration to promote unionization.
Ms. Stevens, are you aware that the announcement that next generation delivery vehicle fleet would be built in South Carolina after the Oshkosh Defense initially won the contract in having facilities in Wisconsin?
Yeah, the Postal Service was made aware of that decision shortly before the public announcement, and it is a decision that's at the discretion of the supplier.
So are you aware that Oshkosh Defense might be trying to circumvent its longstanding contract with the United Auto Workers workforce in Wisconsin by essentially building a brand new facility after the contract was awarded in a vacant warehouse in South Carolina?
I have no awareness of that, but I would encourage you to have that conversation with Oshkosh.
Is the USPS troubled by this timeline at all?
By what was that?
By this timeline at all?
Which timelines are you referring to?
The timeline of the fact that NextGen, they had secured Oshkosh. Oshkosh presented the contract with their existing facilities. They have union labor. They were granted a $3 billion contract under the USPS under the leadership of DeJoy. And then after the ink was dry, it looks like they're opening up a scab facility in South Carolina with no prior history of producing vehicles in that facility.
So I think some of the facts about what was represented in a proposal are not correct. And I would disagree with those assertions.
Okay. And so I would say that the USPS is not troubled by that timeline.
I would agree with your statement.
Thank you.
The gentle lady yields back.
And so, you know, I don't know why Louis DeJoy is still there.
That's part of it.
That's a question that's been really difficult to answer this entire time Biden's been in office.
I suspect there is, it's one of those things of like, is he bad enough that they want to expend energy on trying to get somebody better in? That's usually what it comes down to. But we are, this is, put this in a, in the, he is bad enough column, because there was an opportunity here to make sure that these things were built by union workers. And there is a little bit of an implication that maybe the Postal Service knew what was going on here.
Yeah, I mean, this would be very much in keeping with Louis DeJoy's history. He was a Republican donor before getting this position and has essentially made a name for himself in the USPS as like a cost-cutting guy. So if he wants to, you know, publicly advertise, oh, we're going to use union workers on this, and then secretly behind the scenes undercutting that, that would be very much in keeping with his leadership throughout this time period. I don't understand. Yeah. What are some of the issues that the Biden administration has run into in terms of getting him out?
Well, the Postal Board has to vote him out.
Right. That's the difference.
And it took him a while to appoint the Postal Board. And I don't know where we're at right now, frankly.
And you'd have to appoint a board that would want to get rid of DeJoy.
There are two seats, I think, still available on the postal board. So
yeah,
that may
no
change.
Rush.
But again, it's really just like, how much does the administration want to spend time on that as opposed to like judges?
There's this broader problem with electric vehicles and I think green energy in general and being anti-labor. We saw this with the, I think it was Build Back Better had the, Biden was pushing a credit, tax credit for union made electric vehicles mm-hmm. and Manchin kiboshed it thanks to, in service of a Toyota. And you see
the reason why they do that mm-hmm. is because they want to neutralize the unions in the fight to green the economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the union job, a lot of the jobs that are going to get switched are union jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you replace them with union jobs, there's going to be problems for the unions.
Right.
So getting the unions on board to green the economy is a big deal.
And if and you want unions to like believe in the just transition and be on for a Green New Deal, you need to make sure they see mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Now, which is why this is so damaging.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. Calling from a 971 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Drew calling from Portland, Oregon.
Drew from Portland, Oregon. What's on your mind?
So I wanted to touch on some trans issues first. A few weeks ago, Florida came out with that new like health agency where they're going to basically go after people that were promoting the best practices around COVID. And I was wondering, do you guys think it reminded me of the Jon Stewart interview with the Arkansas Attorney General where they were following all of the guidance for medical issues except for on the trans issue. And I was wondering if you guys think that more red states are going to come up with these health authorities to basically contradict the medical knowledge on trans issues or gay issues and say, you know,
that's a good point.
Maybe conversion therapy works, maybe something like that.
Well,
Go ahead.
No. I need to look something up. So you. Go
well,
ahead.
I, if you had called in with this question 2 months ago, I would have said yes. But there has been a. I think there's an understanding that maybe this doesn't have the political salience that they thought it did, and you know it's worked for. Or there's a perception that it's worked for DeSantis at this point because it worked for him in Florida. It's conceivable to me that a couple other red states may do it. But DeSantis was doing this because he thought of its national value. And I'm quite convinced that DeSantis is going to fall apart at one point. So there may be less of it than there would have been had the Republicans been more successful in this midterm election, right? Because yeah, like what, $50 million? $50 million running ads about so-called issues with trans people in Michigan. And they got destroyed. And so I don't think it has the political salience that they thought it did. And so you may see a ramp down, but the only, you know, but the fact is it's in their bloodstream now. And so they're going to, these politicians are going to react to it. So I don't think it's going to be too bad, but.
But I mean, to your point about how they could be copying the what Florida has done with the CDC. I mean, we thought that they'd be moving away from COVID because we just saw a candidate in Pennsylvania run on medical freedom and lose to John Fetterman. And I don't think that has the salience that it does since we've decided that the pandemic is essentially over and we're not going to. Do any mitigation anymore. So, I mean, I think that your point is correct. I do think that we could see more of that. And there already is a cohort of people out there, medical professionals who are divergent from the consensus, who are willing to provide their credentials for bigotry. We saw it in Arkansas. And that was like what allowed them to pass that ban on gender affirming care. And I think in Tennessee as well. So, I mean, I'm going to be on the lookout for that because I think that's a good point.
Appreciate the call. Chicago letter carrier. Would MR be interested in having the National Association letter carrier's president VP officer on the show? I think we've had that guy on. the National Letter Carriers president. But maybe. Ryan and Callie, I see the words, please clap, in Ron DeSantis's near future. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Judy Rugliani, Sam, could you tell us why you decided against a full day of calls? I don't know that I decided against the full day of calls. I think I decided for no guest in the first hour and take calls.
We are doing a full day of calls. I mean, we're also doing clips.
Well, we had Matthew.
Yeah. And we had Matthew, but...
But it was really the first hour. But I didn't... I got to be honest with you. I didn't even see it as a decision as much as...
I don't think we put that much thought into it.
Mark Antonio, USPS Board of Governors member Lee Moak. Term is up in December, actually, a Trump-appointed member. He is a DeJoy supporter. Biden could replace him, and that would be enough to oust DeJoy. Unfortunately, the National Association of Letter Carriers Union is supporting Lee Moak's reappointment. They are pretty useless. Oof, that's bad. Ryan and Callie, I think you misinterpreted Josh Hawley's statement about stop watching porn. It wasn't part of the prepared speech. It was a direct appeal to the TPUSA live audience to stop self-pleasuring themselves and listen to what he had to say.
All right.
Calling from a 210 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Good afternoon, Sam and Emma. This is John from San Antonio.
John from San Antonio.
So good to hear from you,
so
John.
So glad to hear you one more time in 2022. What's on your mind, John?
Yeah, I want to wish everybody at the Majority Report happy holidays, and I hope everyone has an excellent new year.
Back at you.
Thank you. So, same to you.
All right. Yeah. So one beat that the Majority Report has covered very well is the rise of union activity that has accelerated over the last 2 years. According to the Gallup poll that came out in August, the approval of unions is at its highest level since 1965. And all across the country, at many different kinds of jobs, workers are forming unions, despite the fact that they're getting major pushback from some of their employers, and sometimes losing their jobs for speaking their minds about their work situation. The percentage of people who approve of unions is at 71%, up from a low of 48% in 2010. In 2022, unions won more elections than in any year since 2005, and the winning percentage is at 77%, up from 53% in the year 2000. I encourage workers to continue to form unions and to tip the balance away from upper echelon management. So I'm going to list the top six progressives that were elected in 2022, according to how progressive I think they are. Summer Lee from Pennsylvania.
Oh, hold on for 1 second, John. Let me just weigh in here because this is a good opportunity for me to say this because I wanted to, when we preview 2023, I think one of the biggest stories of 2023, you know, put aside like the campaign stuff and this and that, is going to be the possibility of the largest strike that we've seen in this country against a single company by the Teamsters. I'm talking the UPS strike that I'm not clear on exactly when it's going to go down, but it's going to probably be somewhere between the first quarter of 2023 and the second quarter of 2023. We could see a massive, massive UPS strike. And I think with what you were saying in terms of people's perspective on unions and whatnot, and the sort of the interesting place that UPS drivers now hold in our society in the wake of COVID, it's going to be interesting. There was a UPS strike, I feel like in the 90s, maybe it was. And I don't remember.
USPS or UPS?
UPS.
Oh, okay.
And I don't remember exactly, you know, I don't remember exactly how it went down, but this is going to be big. I think this could be really, really big. And so go ahead, John.
Well, great. I hope they win and, you know, get more money for the workers. So the six progressives are Summer Lee from Pennsylvania, Greg Kassar from Texas, Delia Ramirez from Illinois, Becca Belent from Vermont, Maxwell Frost from Florida, and Andrea Salinas from Oregon. And I especially want to congratulate Greg Kassar, is going to be the most progressive congressperson to ever represent San Antonio, and was elected to be the Congressional Progressive Caucus Whip already. So unfortunately, the Democrats lost the House, and the Democrats need to flip 5 seats to take back the chamber in 2014. The total amount of votes in the closest 5 races that the Democrats lost was only 6,670 votes.
Wow.
So this follows the last 2 presidential elections, where the loser would only have to flip 78,000 votes in 2016 in 3 states, and 44,000 votes, a little less than 78, and a little less than 44,000 in 2020. So elections have been very tight. And lately, every move that a candidate and a campaign makes is extremely important, and the party has to make sure that they're using every advantage that they can to win. So you already commented a little bit on the union movement. I want to know if you want to comment any more on the elections, and if you want to talk any more about some of the best and the worst of 22, that'd be great.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the slow but sure, we're seeing the building of the progressive, the sort of the progressives inside the progressive caucus, as it were. The real issue, I think, is going to be that AIPAC money. Mm. I'm very, you know.
And I'm curious about what Hakeem Jeffries means for the progressive movement.
That's related.
Like we were, you know, Bradley mentioned the mechanism that they were, that some of the conservatives are trying to insert to get McCarthy to do their bidding. I'd love if the left was able to flex their muscle and do that with the speaker.
I just don't think that's their sheer numbers yet, but maybe next time around, you know, there will be. I mean, we've almost like doubled the numbers that were there in 2018 of sort of like squad adjacent people. And it's conceivable that by 2024, you will have another sort of like almost 3 times what there was in 2018. And really what you want to start seeing, because the analogy is not perfect, right? Because they have no agenda other than sort of like where they can get and you know, which sort of ridiculous sideshow will get the most attention. But, you know, you think about like Katie Porter being on the Financial Services Committee again, and some of the other progressives being on things like banking and whatnot. Like they are building up enough strength so they can start to get into these committees. You know, you're talking about very young people, and you're talking about people who don't obviously have seniority within the Democratic caucus. And how do you get the rules changed and such that the seniority is not as determinant? So there's all these things. But John, really appreciate all what you've contributed to this program in 2022, and looking forward to those contributions in 2023.
All right. Looking forward to the third speaker vote day, and that's when you're coming back.
Yeah, so that should be pretty nuts.
Good show.
Appreciate it. Thanks,
John.
Bye-bye.
All right. Happy holidays, John.
Y'all take care.
Bye-bye.
Happy holidays to y'all. Take care.
I want to talk about what's going on in New York State, and it's relevant because to the entire country, because the reason why New York State could have made the difference. We lost 3 seats, right, Bradley, in Congress. Had the other maps, the initial map that the state, the legislature drawn, been in, we would have actually picked up 3. And I think the Democrats would still be in control.
Yeah.
Had that first map. But the reason why that first map did not go through was 2 things. One, because the New York State Democratic Party is garbage, and they did not push these referendums that would have given the power to the legislature to do it. And then 2, because the New York State Supreme Court was stacked with conservatives by Andrew Cuomo.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was anticipating that changing. in opening up the opportunity for the legislature maybe to do some gerrymandering in 2024. Well, Governor Kathy Hochul has nominated within the context of New York State, a hardcore conservative, an appellate judge, a former prosecutor, conservative on defendant rights, conservative on police oversight, conservative when it comes to abortion rights in New York State. LaSalle, this guy, Hector LaSalle, he would be the first Latino who would be the nominated to the chief judge, essentially the state Supreme Court chief judge. Mm. Despite that, I don't think he would do much for that cohort. And you have Gustavo Rivera, senator, who we had on our live show, really amazing senator, say, you know, I know people want to take a lot of pride in the first Latino Supreme Court Chief Justice on the state court, but this guy's garbage. And so there seems to be increasing momentum to vote against this guy. And so if you live in New York State, we'll put a link in the podcast and YouTube description to how to contact your state senator.
Yeah, you just got to go to I'll put the link in there, but just search your address. If you're a New York State resident, they'll give you your state senator and the contact information for their district offices.
Now, it looks like they're close to getting enough to block
them. Understand that when you contact your state senator, I'm going to bet that 95% of you, if you do this, if everyone in New York State does this, I'm going to bet that 95% of you, maybe 98% of you, it's the first time you've contacted your state senator.
Right.
And I'm going to bet that like 75% of you don't even know who that person is. Think about the inverse of that. That is how much influence you're going to have. The fact that you've never done it before, that you didn't even know who this person is a reflection of how much influence you will have. So if you live in Manhattan, there's a decent chance, particularly on the west side, but downtown, uptown, these districts are nuts. You are represented by Brad Hoylman, and he is the chair of the Judiciary Committee that would hold a hearing on him. If you live in the Bronx, you also, Biagi is your state senator. I have a feeling she's going to vote the right way, but contact her anyways.
Contact your state senator no matter what.
If you're in Brooklyn, again, very weird district, Senate, District 20, Zellner Myrie. It's like Sunset Park, and then it sort of just goes down like, I think, 4th Avenue or 3rd yeah. Avenue, and then swings around into Prospect Heights and into Crown Heights. It's very strange.
Yeah, Myrie's mine.
Yep. Contact them. If you are in out in like outer Queens, sort of almost like at the beginning of Long Island City, Anna Kaplan is your Senate. She is on the Judiciary Committee. If you're out like in, I don't even know how to describe this, like sort of in the middle of Long Island, like Bethpage, the Garden City, Uniondale, again, Kevin Thomas, your state senator on the committee. If you're up near New Paltz, in Newburgh, and just south of Poughkeepsie, across the river, James Scoofies is your state senator. Contact him. If you're in like Mount Vernon area, East Bronx, Jamal Bailey. If you're up in Albany, Neil Breslin, both north and south, although not so much east. These districts are nuts. And if you're living out like in Bay Ridge or Gravesend, or by, I think, the airport, I don't know, maybe not so much the airport, maybe closer to, like, part of Brighton Beach. Andrew Gornardes is your senator. But contact your state senator. And if your state senator is a Republican, still contact them. Because what can happen is all it takes is for them to go, like, I'm even getting calls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if they say that and some Democrat overhears it, it just creates a sense of like there's a huge grassroots revolt.
Mm-hmm.
So do it.
My state senator, Brian Kavanaugh. That's lower Manhattan and certain areas of Brooklyn. I will be contacting him for sure. And it's just like there has been a real surge in power from the left in New York State. We've gained elected office. Now it's time to flex our muscle because I would think that Hochul's a bit more vulnerable in this way than Andrew Cuomo, who just had a chokehold on so many power structures in New York State.
Let's talk a little bit about the Twitter files for a second.
Sure.
There has definitely been some stuff of value that are in these archives. It's interesting to see how moderation works. It's interesting to see how in certain instances it's just a matter of incompetence. It was good that Twitter, I think, had a firewall between its PR and comms people. And but it also shows how difficult it is to determine what you're going to moderate and where. I also think that like some of the revelations about the relationship between, you know, Twitter giving almost like a whitelist pass to some governmental agencies.
Yeah, the Fong reporting.
Yes. Inappropriate, and there needs to be more investigations on that, to the extent that we can.
The other part is like that Libs of TikTok was in violation of rules but given special dispensation.
Right. We saw also that, conservatives would get like a higher threshold to be bounced from the platform despite the fact that they were unleashing hate. Now, the downsides of this are that these are selective leaks by a person, a billionaire, with an agenda, regardless of the fact it just so happens that he has a very conservative agenda, but any agenda should be suspect. And the other thing that has also been really sort of about this is that people who perceive themselves as actual journalists, it's one thing to give it to like a Barry Weiss who's just like an opinion journalist. And really, to the extent that she's done any reporting, it's basically like, who's the woke person on campus that is harassing her favorite professor who, and that guy, Schillenberger, who is I don't even know what reporting he's ever done.
Schmuck, yeah.
Yeah, she's but, like, hey, I'm the only one who can harass professors and try to get them canceled.
Yes, they have to be Palestinian. But it's also been fascinating to watch the demise of Matt Taibbi sell out any of his sort of like former journalistic principles. Now, I'm not making that accusation. Matt Taibbi is making that accusation. Remember, Elon Musk gave Matt Taibbi a specific part of the archive, right? Just a specific part of the archive, because we know we don't have access to all of it.
And we know there were conditions as well, and we also know that there's stuff that hasn't been reported, including from Taibbi himself saying that there were communications between the Trump White House and Twitter, which should be newsworthy. If the Biden campaign's communications were newsworthy, the Trump White House's would definitely be, would it not?
It's far worse because yes. They're a government.
They're in office.
They're not a campaign. They're not like some business essentially trying to get elected. Hey, man, don't write that story about our cars, smelling bad or whatever it is. That happens all the time with this social media. But the real point is that you have journalists walking out there who have built their reputation on being journalists and had principles even as short ago as a year ago saying like, you don't take information like that. But again, this is not my accusation. It's an accusation made against Matt Taibbi by Matt Taibbi.
Mm.
It's an accusation made against Matt Taibbi 2022 from Matt Taibbi 2021 on the Joe Rogan program.
Story that's like sort of apropos to all this is in Seymour Hersh's book, it's his memoir, Reporter. There's a story about how in the early 90s, the CIA wanted everybody to know that they had caught this. I think it was an Israeli spy. And so they called up Hersh because Hersh was the biggest, investigative reporter in the country. And they invited him in and they said, look, we're going to show you all this material, right? And they brought him into a room and they just gave him a whole packet of stuff, right? But he couldn't, like, his entire body rebelled. He's like, I had spent my whole life getting the things. I could not be handed the things. You know what I mean? Because it's just not in his nature, right? Like, to be, you know, to be spoon-fed.
Right.
And, like, I think that's true with comics, with any kind of journalist. Like, once you start getting, you know, handed things, then you've lost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They have you at that point. And you got to get out of that habit, you know? It's like, or you just never, you can't cross that line.
You can't cross that line. Yeah. You can't, but if you want to be on a talk show.
All right. Yeah, you cannot cross that line. Because then they have you.
That was a weird.
That's what's frustrating about the like thing. To the extent that there's anything real here, and there's plenty, I assume, to be interesting to the public about how a major communications network is governed. You can't.
I mean, even our
it.
Slack channel would be somewhat interesting, but not that.
Yeah, but you can't trust like the Fong stuff. Like, Fong even said like he was given a certain part of this, but he wasn't like is handled as much as like the other people were. But that said, like their stuff with regards to like the Saudi influence on Twitter and maybe the Israeli influence on Twitter, like is Barry Weiss going to be digging into that?
Yes, you don't know. We don't like the idea that Elon Musk does not have an agenda here is like beyond naive. It's insane. It's you have to be crazy. Willfully ignorant.
You have to be a
it.
Useful idiot.
And yes. And to accept this cache of stuff and just assume that you're reporting the full story and not just doing the bidding of, you know, a lot, like when they said like, we can't release this because we're doing some fact checking. This is Musk saying, I want this tranche of stuff given because he has an agenda. And Taibbi, as recently as a year ago, understood this dynamic. You're being used. And as soon as you cross that line, it's over.
Yeah, but it's just easier to stomach that when you become central to like a billionaire's narrative who owns a major social media platform. And then you can have like you can direct people to your Substack. That's what it is. It's money now. That's the difference.
It's money. It's delusions of grandeur. It's just general delusions of being aggrieved, I think, in his case.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because
he knows better and he thinks everyone's stupid.
Yep.
And he's treating everybody as if they're stupid. I mean, in the Fong thing, here's my reported piece with more detail. I was given access to Twitter for a few days. I signed/agreed to nothing. Twitter had no input into anything I did or wrote. The searches were carried out by a Twitter attorney, so what I saw could be limited.
Could be.
And it's just like all this stuff, like this is what a limited hangout is,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like,
what is the value then if the attorney is present and providing you with information? What is the value?
Look, I mean, I think there's certain... that's the thing is you can't
assess it. Is really the problem.
From the meta conversation.
You can't assess it. That's the thing. There may be value there, but you can't assess it. You can't trust it.
No, you can't. I would love to see the Twitter archives in full. Like I would love to see some sort of leak where we were able to see files from a certain period of time, but not handpicked and selected by Elon Musk. I mean, that's the opposite of what journalism should be on this front.
Now, just as evidence of the fact that Taibbi, you know, sort of has had a 360 or a 180 on this, play this clip. It just came through from Dorsey. This clip right here. Like, again, last December, once you get handed things, you're lost. And then take it. Yeah. Volume.
The fact that Elon has an agenda here is not in any way disqualifying. But given that you're sort of dependent on him and his process for what documents are ultimately able to review, how have you been able to ease your own concerns that what you're looking at isn't somehow cherry-picked or skewed or selective versus a more complete picture?
Well, I mean, the minute I get the indication that I'm being played or something like that, I'll of course, you know, jump out of the airplane. I mean,
pause it. But
I
haven't seen that. In other words, just trust me. Yep. I got this. There's no principle associated with this. Even though I look back a year ago, I was reading Cy Hirsch's book, and he's telling, like, the idea is when you get handed it, not whether you think you're being played. You're being played when you get handed it. It's over.
Yeah, he said, and he corrected himself. He was originally going to say it's hard to get out of that habit.
Right.
And then said, well, you can't actually get into that habit at all.
All right, continue.
Not at all. I've had no indication of that.
Oh, okay.
Look, people keep bringing this question up. We go, you're doing PR for the richest man in the world. Yeah. What about his motives? Blah, blah. And, you know, like, it doesn't matter. Like, journalists, we don't care where the information comes from. If it's true, we want to look at it. I know what my motives are. My motives are, I'm looking at, like, I'm getting a unique look into the underbelly of how censorship works in this country and how the FBI, the DHS, the Pentagon, like all of these institutions and how they operate in secret. That's an incredible opportunity. And I know what I'm looking for. So it doesn't, I guess there might be motives that he might have, but that doesn't matter for the integrity of the project. All we have to do is make sure that the stuff that we're looking at is true and accurate, and that we're drawing the correct conclusion.
The idea, I mean, the idea that the context does not matter at all. I mean, it's one thing for him to get this information and look at it and think this is interesting, but then you do further reporting.
You vet it.
You not just vet that this stuff is true. And if you think this is true, I can tell you something that is true between a conversation that you and I have. But if I don't share your half of the conversation, just my half of the conversation, it's true. We still don't know what the nature of the conversation mm-hmm. was. You can't look at one siloed thing that is chosen by a guy who you think he has an agenda. Of course he has an agenda. It's not reporting. You're just putting out what he is giving you. I mean, would he, if the CIA sat down with him and said, here's a file, every single thing in it is true, report it as is, you don't think that he would say, like, I'm a little suspect of this. Why does the CIA want to give me this? Wait a second. This is the CIA's perspective. What about the perspective of the people living on the ground?
Yeah.
Even if they say what is true. Like, that's all bullshit. The amount of self-delusion or rationalization or whatever. Like, I don't know why he's doing it. I know what the value accrued to him is, but I don't know if that's why he's doing it as much as a sense of aggrievement, or I had been wrong before, this is the way I make my bones as a contrarian, or whatever it is, or just like, I know better than everybody else. The reason why this question keeps coming up
is because it's
so obvious.
Fundamental.
Yes, and honestly, the stakes are much lower with this. But this is indistinguishable from what Judith Miller essentially was doing during her reporting at the New York Times, which was like, I hear this from my national intelligence source, and because it is told to me and I've made an assessment that this is the fact, I'm going to report it. And
she was worse. I think she was a little bit more nefarious.
And that's why I say the stakes were much higher in that instance, and you have to really do your due diligence on that front. But like, that was the exact kind of reporting that this crop of reporters was critiquing and saying, we need to be different and better than this. And he's essentially saying, this guy has given me information and I trust it, and that's all I really need to say. All I really need to provide for you.
Honestly, it's the capitalists, not the government, and I think for like a lot of the libertarians in the audience of these guys, that's enough.
And they're not reporting on what the Trump administration did at this time when they were the only government entities who were contacting Twitter.
Well, that's political. And I mean, that's the thing is like, that's the basic, that's media literacy 101, or maybe it's 102. Which is that, why are you learning what you are learning when you're learning it mm-hmm. in which sort of publication? And like the thing, like, well, if some of the stuff is true, that's all that matters. Well, like, the CIA knows that. That's why they'll admit to certain smaller things to keep you off of bigger things. And I repeat, how about you do a control find about Saudi Arabia or what Israel wants to do with regards to these things, as opposed to just Democrats the entire time?
The idea that that stuff hasn't been vetted out is ridiculous. And honestly, The what what the internal conversations are about the purchase of Twitter for $44 billion, that's not interesting. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
Give me a break.
Wait, I would love to see. I mean, this is Mr. Transparency. Are we going to have some sort of Twitter files on any pieces of information that started once Elon Musk purchased and purchased Twitter?
No.
No?
No.
Okay, so of course not transparency. Transparency for thee and not for me, and it's not even transparency at all.
Calling from a 786 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi.
Hi. Huh? Hi. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Got to be quick. Hey. Got to be quick when I get a couple of people.
Yes, I'll be very quick. Yeah, this is Robert and Trevor calling from Pittsburgh. Long-time listeners, first-time callers.
Robert and Trevor?
I'm actually really surprised we got through.
Well,
Yeah, the reason we're calling is I wanted to tell you about a book and an author who I think you might want to interview. The book is called God and Anatomy, and the author is Professor Francesca, I'm going to butcher this, Stavrakopoulou. But it's a really interesting book. She's a professor of the Hebrew Bible and ancient religion, and the book is kind of like a biography of God. It explores kind of like the ancient religion of Israel when it was polytheistic, and how Yahweh went from the god of war and thunder, who was one of many, and how he was kind of transformed into the sole god of Judaism. I recently watched a interview with the author, and I told my boyfriend to buy me the book for Christmas, so I haven't read it yet, but the interview was really fascinating. Like I said, it's basically Yahweh's biography, how he went from being the son of El, being transformed into like El Shaddai, how he went from having a wife and kids to being just the one and only God of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So again, it's called God and Anatomy, and the author is really fascinating. I just think it might be something you want to look into.
Appreciate the suggestion. We'll look into it. Thanks for calling. Have a happy new year.
Yeah. And thank you. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year. Right.
And all that, all the happy holidays. Call from an 863 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello?
Hello? Mm-hmm. Yes? Got to be quick. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hey. My name's Antonio.
Antonio, where are you calling
from? From Florida, Polk County, Florida.
Okay, what's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I'm a little surprised. I didn't think I'd get through. I've been trying to get through all year.
Well, now's your opportunity. Don't waste it on the surprise.
All right. Well, no, I'm just calling because in this week, Gates and his whole little, I guess, squad of conservatives, fascists, whatever you want to call them, they keep talking about how they're not going to vote for Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah.
But in the end, I don't know why it's why anybody's giving them any air to what they say, because it's all performative. In the end, everybody knows they're going to vote for him anyways. Because if they don't, it's going to delay anything they can do while they have control of the House. And I don't think the Republicans are going to be all too happy, especially those in power, if they sort of mess up that time for them.
I mean, you may be right. It's going to be interesting to see. It certainly will be, without a doubt.
Yep, and that's all I was calling for,
Appreciate the call, man. Have a happy holidays. Happy New Year.
All right, happy holidays. Bye.
Bye. Take another phone call. A lot of calls today. Calling from a 612 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, my God. Is this me?
It is you.
Wow, this is so cool. Hi, I'm Rebus. This is I'm from the Twin Cities.
Rebus from the Twin Cities. What's on your mind?
I guess I had something a bit longer planned, but I don't want to take too much time. So I'm actually sort of a younger listener. I've sort of gotten into you guys since the Steven Crowder ambush thing.
Nice.
Saw that on Hassan's stream, and I thought that was really funny. Yeah, I'm a really, really big fan. Sorry, I'm a little, I tried to call in once before, and I messed it up. Anyway, I'm just going to keep this quick. I was looking for your IMDb, Sam, because I am an animation student. I go to art school, and I'm really fascinated with cartoons and stuff. So, you know, I realized you were from Bob's Burgers and stuff, and was like, wow, that's really cool. I looked on your IMDb, and it says you were on an episode of The Magic School Bus.
I can't remember. A friend of mine worked for that.
I was trying to figure that out.
I can't remember what it was, to be honest with you.
It was on a zoo episode, I think. Something about a zoo.
Bring that up.
I may have been an animal. I can't remember, to be honest with you. A friend of mine works there. I think she still does work there, actually. And this was years and years and years ago. And I think I did a quick recording for her.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, I'm a little starstruck, sorry. I'll try calling in again next time for my other topic when it's not...
No worries. But also, I did Saddle Rash, Assy McGee. I was on Home Movies. I did a bunch of, like, with that crew of people. But Magic School Bus was something different.
It's a Magic School Bus episode in the city, 1997. Miss Frizzle's class is visiting the zoo,
appreciate
which is, according to Tim, the only place in the city where wild animals can survive.
Sam was on the Magic School Bus?
What was I playing?
To test this idea, I don't think it says what you were playing. No.
I don't know. I don't remember.
I love the jokes about how, like, Miss Frizzle...
So you're playing a Velveteen Rabbit, so...
Should we do the Crowder thing? Should we speculate on that? Oh, let's do it, Candace Owens. Yeah, should we do that?
Sure. Sure. She's been on one recently.
Candace Owens is still sort of like reeling from the Kanye stuff. Mm-hmm. At, you know, like, you got to play it up, like when your boss, when you're having problems with Shapiro. Mm-hmm. But then what you got to do is pivot hard.
Yeah.
And this is what she does. This is... Candace Owens being asked a question, your thoughts on the Confederate flag.
Oh, boy.
Thoughts on the Confederate flag. I do not see a problem with people whose family members died fighting for that flag to be able to wave it high. It is
pause
historical.
It for 1 second. Let's just.
Historical.
Would you feel the same way, let's say, if it was ISIS? If not ISIS, would you feel it the same way for if it was, I mean, let's be honest, like, it's not a country. Right? This is not a country's flag. Mm. So we can't analogize it to a country. It really is just like a band of rebels.
Yeah. How about the Antifa flag?
What about a Ukrainian flag?
Which is actually an existing country.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let's continue here. Then we'll get into like what that flag represented.
Yeah, what did they die fighting for?
Exactly.
And the idea that your son or daughter went and marched in a war, people are just so stupid. They think they were fighting for slavery. Those people who fought were piss poor. They never had a slave a single day in their life. They fought for the South, and their sons signed up, went to war.
Pause it. Hold on for a second. First off, no, the idea that somebody's dying for a flag is absurd. Nobody dies for a flag. What does it mean that you fought for the South? Like, what does that mean? Like, you fought for the, like, what was, like,
we
what,
fought
what
for
that?
Warmer climates in the United States.
Exactly. Like, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything.
They were literally, like, paranoid about, like, miscegenation and stuff like that. Like, you're going to create.
But also, let's also be clear. There is no war where the people who fight it are necessarily fighting for the reasons why the war is being mm-hmm. waged.
You can't critique any war because there have been impoverished soldiers throughout history.
And
I mean,
the flag is not for those soldiers. The
no.
flag is for like the slave owners at the head of the cavalry who like paid for all the horses and stuff and are actually motivating all these people to go to war. That's who the flag is.
It is
for.
A fake like it is a false way to make her justification for protecting slave owners be more like populist because there were poor people involved.
You know what? Poor Confederate soldiers. I like the ones who deserted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And let's be clear. The uniforms that they wore. The food rations that they ate. the ammunition and the weapons? They didn't pay for those.
Yeah, who moved the stuff to the battlefield?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Slaves! But continue.
That even having the flag or having any pride for their dead relatives is something that is wrong and dirty and backwards and racist and associated with slavery. People are so ignorant about slavery and the numbers on slavery. I mean, the idea that everyone had slaves in the South is so stupid. It was the incredibly uber wealthy. People believing that everyone today had a yacht. I mean, it's just so
middle class.
I'm just going to stop talking about that. The answer is people should be allowed to keep their Confederate flags and wave them because it represents an element of history.
They are allowed.
She's
to.
Wrong about
they,
that.
But they are allowed to. There's no law against it. She can. They conflate those things because there's just some sort of social penalty that makes it illegal. No, you can be an asshole and fly it on your private land. That's fine. But it doesn't need to be a part of state flags, a part of state houses. No, it's just uncouth, and that's okay.
Do you think that there is a line in which she would actually say that it's not enough that it existed in history to be able to wave it? Like, let's say, I don't know, Nazi flag. I don't know if she would have a problem with that. It's history. Maybe she wouldn't have a problem with that. What about like nooses? It's also a part of history. Would you have a problem with that?
She'd probably say no because this is her value to the right. She can be a black person that says that that's okay.
I mean,
and she leans into it very enthusiastically.
Is there anything that you should not be, or that you should not be not discouraged from proudly displaying simply because it's part of history? I mean, it's just an absurd standard.
We also don't have laws against that stuff. It's just about, like, social ramifications for it. And I'm sorry, you can't discipline people into feeling okay with the Confederacy and racism. There's going to be some social consequences for you if you are still that retrograde.
It's also just simply a lie that only the uber ultra wealthy Confederates had slaves. 1809, a slave was roughly $60,000. So it's basically like the investment of a SUV. A lot of middle class, upper middle class families did participate in that market.
I would invite Candace Owens also to read any of some of the state constitutions, the revised state constitutions that the secessionists submitted before they seceded. They are some of the most baldly racist and pro-slavery pieces of history that I've ever seen in my entire life. And they're all completely focused on the fact that the South is seceding for slavery.
But those people fighting didn't write that.
Mm.
That's right. The poor people didn't write it. The poor soldiers didn't write it, I guess.
All right. Dorsey thinks he's found the go.
No way.
That we've. Yeah. Let's see. Magic school bus here. It's funny because Milo was big into it, and I don't even think I remembered at the time.
Loved Magic School Bus. Like the days where you would come into class and they'd have the lights down and the TV sort of thing was set up, and we were just going to watch Magic School Bus to learn about blood cells or something. That was awesome.
I do love like just the notion that this teacher shrunk people down to a small size so she could go in like her second grade student's intestine. It's like a little traumatic, but yeah.
Yeah.
I see what you mean. It could be a cave if you were desperate.
And the bus was desperate. And here it is. Sound asleep.
Hey, Hal. Over here.
We've got to try and keep them away from here. I'll see if I can distract them.
What was that?
A fox. And a real beauty, too.
I'm not surprised. Why, I've seen whole families of foxes in that old graveyard back there.
It didn't do any good. They weren't interested
in me. Is
there
that's you?
No, yeah. They know that sometimes foxes live in the city.
But how are we going to get rid of the zookeeper before he finds the bus?
Now don't worry, class. Leave it to me.
What's that? Looks like a raccoon. No way! I'm gonna mess with an angry raccoon.
She must have her family hidden around here somewhere.
Better come back tomorrow when she's asleep.
This isn't
Yay!
It.
You did it!
Damn.
Yeah, I
don't think
no.
That was quite enjoyable, though.
I don't think that's me either.
Might have been you.
Hey, it may be the southern guy.
Yeah, the more garish accent.
Yeah, that could have been me.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's your preview to Alex Jones, right?
I don't know. Well, that's worth trying. That's where could be 2023 is going to be about figuring that out. This, if we're talking about 2023, this I think is instructive. Steve Bannon at TPE USA America Fest. This was on Monday of this week. Donald Trump is running out of advisors. And there is no doubt in my mind that Bannon is advising this guy. We played a clip of Charlie Kirk talking to Bannon and doing this whole sort of populist line. And again, I remind you of this week, you know, we had a great talk where the outlining the differences between left-wing populism and right-wing populism. Right-wing populism or left-wing populism sees an elite at the top of the income and political distribution and realizes that that is the nature of the game, that that is the way that you deal. We have an oligarchy, if you want to call it. You can call it a plutocracy. We have gone from a plutonomy to a plutocracy where an elite group of – and elite's really the wrong word. Moneyed, wealthy, capitalist, and powerful is really what it is. And by definition, there's very few of those people who are controlling things. Whereas on the right, they perceive that elite as well, but they also tie it in to the people who are marginalized in terms of political and economic power in society. Immigrants, trans people, brown people, black people. And that is their difference, and that is what they're espousing. And here is Steve Bannon essentially moving from the philosophical into the sort of practical. What is the game plan for the Trumpites in Congress? And we're watching this play out right now with these fights as to who's going to get power and who's going to be the one to carry this message. But here's Steve Bannon explaining what they intend to do.
Impeaching Joe Biden's too good for him. Then we got to bring the criminal charges and send him to prison for treason and selling out this country. Is there any doubt you've gone through the laptop from hell? Remember, it was a year later and they spent all that time with Twitter and Facebook and all of them prepping and saying, oh, this is Russian disinformation. They did. They had all of our phones tapped. They had mine. They had Rudy's. Had everybody's. I was
pause it for 1 second. I just want to remind you, we'll start this over again. They never talk about what's in the laptop.
Yes.
There's just an assumption.
You all know.
You're completely aware of what's in that laptop from hell. And now I'm going to spend the bulk of my message on the process that kept it from everybody else. But we never, ever hear what's in the laptop.
It just is salacious. So it must be corrupt. That's the leap that they want people to make.
If you hear, like, think about how much time you've heard about the subjugation of that information and how little amount of time you've heard about the actual information. If this was really a question for them about this information did not get out to the American public, what they would actually be doing if there was information there is they'd be sharing that information instead of sharing about how nobody heard about the information.
And it's not like they didn't have complete access. They had the damn hard drive. Like, so, they have everything. So...
impeaching Joe Biden's too good for him. Then we got to bring the criminal charges and send him to prison for treason and selling out this country. Is there any doubt you've gone through the laptop from hell? Remember, No. It was a year later and they spent all that time with Twitter and Facebook and all of them prepping and saying, oh, this is Russian disinformation. They did. They had all of our phones tapped. They had mine. They had Rudy's. Had everybody's. I was working on it. They knew what they were doing. This is all out in the open now. It was an open coup. by Ray and Barr and the DHS, CIA, and the people that work for them. And we, all politics is performative until we get the investigations and get to the bottom of every name, the 51 intelligence officers and everybody else that sold this country out. All these traitors must go to prison. All traitors must go to prison. All traitors must go to prison.
Yeah.
Just a reminder, Barr, Ray, appointed by Donald Trump.
Mm.
The idea that Bill Barr was, I mean, Bill Barr got hired because he wrote like a 6-page memo trying to defend Trump against impeachment charges.
People like Bannon are good at taking definitions and applying them to the left as a way to completely like scrub themselves of responsibility. Like, we're not the traitors, they're the true traitors, even though I was a huge part of an attempt to overturn a democratic election in this country.
And projection.
I mean, it's not just projection too. I think it's conscious. They're trying to, everybody's a traitor, so I can't be a traitor.
Yep.
Trump can't be a traitor.
All right, folks, the final phone call of the year. I don't know. Hang on, because it's got to be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Matt's a little concerned. Calling from a 360 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
Yes, it is. You very well may be the final call of the year.
Fantastic. My name is Charlie from Washington. My pronouns are she, her, and it's an honor to address the lady Sam Cedar.
All right. There you go. So
hi,
far, doing well, Charlie.
I'm going to blow through this as quickly as possible, and I'll hang up so I can let you guys get back to it. So, last night I was watching Mike Figueredo on the Humanist Report. He covered a Vice documentary that follows around three families who are currently trying to flee Texas with their trans kids.
Uh-huh.
They're looking to go to states that won't extradite them back to Texas. California is one of them. I don't remember what the other two are. Now, in Western Washington, I felt pretty safe as a trans lady. I was able to start my HRT with the informed consent from Planned Parenthood. I hit the one-year mark of that HRT on Tuesday, and it's been the happiest and healthiest I've ever been in my life.
Oh, congrats.
And, congrats.
Well, thank you. So much so that other people tell me I look happier, brighter, lighter, all of that kind of stuff. But disappointingly, my state is not one of those states on that list. And I want any family who does decide to come here, I mean, rent's a little high, but any family who does come here to feel that safety. So my question is, because I'm kind of civically dense, how would one go about trying to get a law enacted like that in our state? Because as much as I agree with you that it is a losing issue for the Republicans are kind of notorious for never letting go of losing issues. I mean, look at their stance on tax cuts.
I don't think anybody's let me put it this way. I don't think any laws on the books are going to be reversed. Let's put it that way. I just don't know how much they're going to, you know. But yes,
I'm not talking about reversing laws. These are laws specifically to protect people.
No. The point I was making that it wasn't electorally beneficial for them. I don't think they're going to reverse their stances in any way. I just don't think they're going to necessarily much. But yes, I think it's a worthwhile endeavor, and this is what you would do. You're in Washington State, you said?
Yes.
Okay. Find a state senator or whatever, state assemblyman or assembly person, or, you know, I don't know what kind of, I off the top of my head, I don't know what kind of houses you have. Find one who has made statements that suggest that they are allies, and write their or call their office and ask if they would contemplate pushing a piece of legislation like that. And then I think the idea would be like, you got to find an organization. Maybe you could do it yourself, but you want maybe sort of like organizational support to write the piece of legislation and give it to this lawmaker so that they, if they are amenable, to begin to push it.
That sounds good.
And you know what I would do is find the legislation in California Find the actual statute, and then just
what is it here?
Rewrite it, or just even use that and say, we should have one of these in our state as well.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. But like I said, we didn't really do good civics in our high school when I was growing up. Anyway, left is best. Protect queer kids. Take back our bodily autonomy. And have a safe and happy holidays, y'all. Appreciate what you do.
Yeah. All right, appreciate the call.
Thanks, Charlie.
Bye-bye. L. Conniption, is this truly a last show of the year without an appearance from Digby? You know what? I just decided, let's do the beginning of the year.
Nice.
Let's do the beginning of the year. Folks, that was the final call of the year because it was successful. So we're going to do a couple IMs and then we will wrap it up for 2023.
Wow.
Oh my God. Hi, happy Friday. Happy holidays. Can't watch live. So I rely on the fun half link in the members only podcast description. Get the full show on YouTube. When you don't put it there, I don't either get the what? Okay. All right. I'm not going to waste the time on that. Please reconsider. Okay. Chibbles. Hey, MR crew. I was wondering if y'all would speak a little bit on the jail New York City is trying to build in Chinatown, despite what Mayor Adams had claimed about no new jails. I have not been following that. Have you?
I need to look more into it. I remember what it was the... I don't want to comment on it until I've read more than just like a few paragraphs.
2023. Can we get a shofar for the unionization effort at the Science Museum of Minnesota? We certainly can. A square. Happy Feliz for all the holidays, Sam, Emma, Matt, Bradley, Brendan, Matt, Free, Twitter, Binder, and Brandon. And to all the regular callers and live chat room, you give me light. Enjoy the time off. See you in 2023. Same to you. Wonder Breader. It's pretty crazy. He has clerks write this instead of them reading the bill. This made Kennedy's video on the bill look good. Radio Tech. I love that in the spirit of giving Christmas, Rand Paul made a commercial chastising the government for giving money to help its citizens. Once again, the GOP are the true villains. This war on Christmas. Worcester Ice Cats. The Dedham Library temporarily took down their Christmas tree and ended up on Jesse Waters multiple times before they put it back up. Oh, that's lovely. Dago Lefty. Sam, I don't know if you saw this so-called zero-staff McDonald's in Texas. It has me racking my brain. McDonald's can't even keep their McFlurry machines operational. How the hell? Well, first off,
it's not.
If you scroll down,
yep,
you will find out that it is not fully automated. Just part of it is. It's really just more of a no-touch situation.
Yeah, the workers are downstairs. There's a dumb waiter bringing the food up for
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Yeah. And it is, and to be clear, it is also just like it is a prototype in the same way that I don't know, car companies create mm-hmm. one. Like,
yeah.
Car with no steering wheel, that type of thing.
Well, Elon will actually make that, but...
Yeah.
But as a person who did work at McDonald's, I got to say, the idea of being able to work at McDonald's and not interact with the customers is actually pretty dope. But I don't think that's why McDonald's is motivated.
But I saw people posted something like, oh, this is what you get when you get a $25
oh, yes.
minimum wage. It's like... Dude,
that's part
Texas
of the deal.
Does not have a $25 minimum wage.
No, yeah, all those people doing boss propaganda.
But they are. But that is what this push to robotize or that's not even the word, but automate these things. That's a way to undercut labor as well.
Bingo dango. Can we not use the term medical freedom when describing the position of candidates like Oz? I feel like that's giving them too much credit for their actual beliefs. An average person sounds positive.
I mean, I was just that was his. It was a shorthand for me to describe what he was branding himself as.
Train Boy, if it's so hard for a person of color to make movies in the 50s, 60s, how come we have so many great directors of that era were Italians? Also, the best movie is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone because of its innovative, unique, and sensitive depiction of what race and bankers would look like, talk, and act like. The facts have a liberal bias. Tulsi's folks are deep into a Hare Krishna crypto-fascist guru back in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Kowalski from Nebraska. Howdy, Sam. Hello, Emma. Sup, Bradley. Matt, thank you all for this program, your individual products. I hope 2023 projects will be as successful and rewarding. You all deserve it. May the Christmas spirit give you the strength for the 2023 trials and tribulations. By Christmas spirit, I mean the spirit of John Brown. Do not compromise those John Brown would have liberated from their mortality. Left is John Brown. And let's see. We'll do five more. Slam Cedar. That was obviously Sam saying, I'm going to come back when she's asleep. Your monitors aren't good enough. Seize the means of production. To be fair, banning it takes a lot of time to process all the pixels necessary to capture the image of Hunter's trouser snake. Bowers, Maine, I'm not sure that Never Trump Republicans understand the problem is greater than Trump. My mom voted for Lee Zeldin despite saying she would not vote for Trump if he runs again. When I told her about his election-denying shenanigans, she sort of brushed it off. Of course not. They don't care. Travis from Dallas. Rand Paul looks like a discount Bond villain in that clip. And the final, I am. Of 2023.
Whoa.
Have you read my email? I will spare you my terrible English and horrendous accent, but I do want to wish you all very happy holidays and a very good year. All the love from the Netherlands. Folks, thank you so much for your support in 2022. We look forward to 2023. We're going to have a lot to talk about. Hope you all have a happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, and a happy, healthy new year. We will be back live January 3rd, and we'll be back in like mid-April.
The 11th. I'll be back.
11th month, November.
Yeah, right. That I'm keeping it purposefully ambiguous.
Everybody want to say goodbye?
You guys want to turn to yourselves? Or?
Well.
No?
Sure.
Okay. I
don't know if I have that even ready available. Oh, yeah, here we are.
There you are. Hey.
See you guys.
Bye, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Happy New Year.
Happy holidays.
See you later. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid.